All right, what's going on, guys?
So, let me know.
Yeah, right. So here's the hardest part of the day. We've already lost a lot from the fallout of lunch. My goal is to make sure that this part of this presentation is really exciting because we're all going to go into food coma. Now, luckily, Oh, yeah. All right, hold on. Let me get set up. Yeah, I'm all trying to go in. I can't even see. All right, hold on. I couldn't eat with this thing in my mouth, so I had to kind of figure it out. And there we go. Okay, there we go. Now we're back, and we got, yeah, good? Okay. Whoa, sheesh. Okay, so I'm gonna do what I normally do, which is screw stuff up and go off scripture a little bit. If I can, how did I do it? See, there we go. I wanted to go to this screen. There we go. I want to start off with, I want to show you a little money, right? Like a deal, okay? So this is a real deal that I'm doing. This, I'm under contract in this deal right now. I just thought I would, because we're getting ready to start talk about, you know, we're finding the deals and stuff and underwriting, a little bit of that kind of stuff. And so I just thought it'd be cool just to show you a real live one that I'm under contract with. So this is called Carolina Creek. It's 511 beds. Now, it's a student housing property built in 2010. That guy, Chris Epp, that I talked about earlier, he's the one that gave me this deal off market, right? No other people. I went direct with the seller. Had to put, now this one was a little bit dicey. I was a little nervous, but I put $400,000 hard on day one. So now ask me if it was my money. No, it wasn't. I called another friend and I said, listen, I'll give you 5% of my GP. You're going to stroke 400K. He's like, great. Glad to do it. Right, so I want to tell you guys, like, in this game of Monopoly that we're playing, you just have to be resourceful. Right? Now, you may not know that 400K guy yet, but they're out there. They're out there every day. And you can find a way to partner with them in the correct way that brings value to them. You know, this guy that, these guys are actually in real estate with me. But they just saw it as an opportunity. They're like, oh, I get 18% on my money plus I get part of the GP. That sounds like a win. I'm down. Right? And I know, what did I do? I had to disclose all the risk. Like, your money's at risk on day one. Right? But they knew my track record and they've seen me do it a lot of times. And so they were very happy to say, we would love the honor. Right? And that's really cool to hear the word like that. To come into your deal and get some GP, right? And so that's the beauty of this game, is you can structure it in a lot of ways to make everybody win. And so everybody in this deal is going to win. And I'm going to show you, and now we're going to go, so here's the deal. I wanted you to see it first. And now let's go, can we go look at the numbers? Can we look at the numbers? All right, let's play a look at the numbers. All right. So, but first of all, I mean, this looks like a real complex, right? Like, this one, you kind of be, I'm proud of this one. A little bit newer. And they're all three-story. They're all actually townhomes. It's townhomes. So this is a student housing property that was built as a townhome property. One door, three stories, right? But they transitioned into college pretty from close to when they built it. They started training. It serves the college. So East Carolina University is 2 miles away. It's got 25,000 students. It's a D1 school. And our USP, unique selling proposition for this property, is that it is townhomes. They're very large rooms. So most college kids get like, you know, they're small. And there's, a lot of times it's 4-2. Like four bedrooms and they two baths and they have to share kind of like a bath. Well, this is three threes. meaning, and everybody gets their own floor. So it's really cool. It's just, and they got walk-in closets, and like it's just set up a lot nicer. Now, there's properties that are closer to college, so I'm a little bit away, and that was I'm a little bit hesitant when I like being closer to the property. But this property right now is rented or leased up for the rest of the school year, and it's at 97%. So when I close, I'm going to buy a property that's already cash flowing. It's making money. And by the way, they got a rent increase for this school year, right? And East Carolina University just had its best ever freshman enrollment with that was the best in the last 10 years. So that means sophomore, junior, seniors, right? That's because most freshmen have to live on campus. So, you know, I've got the next 3 years. It gets better for me. So I know, like, next year, if I can get that sophomore into my unit, they'll stay for the rest of the 3 years. That's typically what happens when they find, once they get out of dorm housing, because everybody wants to get out of dorms. We all know this, right? Because that sucks, right? But coming into my place, now that's something, you know, so we're going to do really well. Yep. Earnest money deposit. Yep. Correct. 12-month leases, always student housing, 12-month leases. And here's the best part, mom and dad's cosign. So I'm protecting my money with mom and dad's credit score. And listen, your collections are very, very little. Like there's not much people that don't pay. Right? So it's a really beautiful model. Now, that's the pros. Some of the cons is they're college kids, right? They're like rabbits. They want to break everything and put holes, and they get parties, and they punch holes in walls. And so you got to corral them. Now 75% of our students are women, right? So we really cater to, I call them hover moms. Come in with their daughter, and my daughter's got to have the best. You know, and so you shock and awe them. You make a nice front entryway. You know, it's like this one here has got a really cool. It's already this one's got a really unique play, and I'll talk about it. Is that so? The play here is they renovated about 15% of the units, right? And when they did a renovation, they did new furniture. They painted like the normal like oak cabinets to the dark cherry, like real dark wood with stainless steel or. Brass nickel, like hinges, LVP flooring, I like that little wood-looking strip flooring, gray walls, and stainless steel appliances, right? So it's about a $10,000 upgrade to do that work, right? But they're getting $75 more per bed when they do that work. And so that's what I love about the student housing thing is we're going to raise our rents almost like escape kind of velocity, like bell curve, not bell curve, but whatever that curve is, the exponential curve. There you go. Thank you. It's been a while since I've been in math class. And so the $75 per bed is huge, is really good. But my cost to run those units doesn't do that, right? It's just like it's just a bedroom, right? So if I, as I hold student housing over time, it really starts to generate a lot of cash flow, right? And you're going to see that this deal cash flows a lot from day one. So we'll go in here to some of my underwriting, okay? Now, huh? This is in Greenville, North Carolina. So Raleigh would be where you would fly into, and you go east. And, you know, so by the way, this is the cash flow calculator, okay? This is what I gave everybody that showed up that got here early, they got one. For everybody else, I'm going to find the solution with Vina. I might have to find a way to do a text or something like that. We're going to talk here probably on my next break on how we can make sure everybody gets that the software. More importantly, I need to try to get you guys the training, and that's what I'm going to give to Vina of how to use this. But what all it does is we've put all the numbers, and the way my software really works is if it's in light blue on the assumption tab, this is where you put most of the data. If it's in a white, that means that's a field that doesn't change, right? It's auto-calculated. And I've locked it, so you can't break it, right? But I also, if you hit the welcome tab, there's instructions on how to unlock it so you can break it on your own, okay? Just make sure you save a master copy. That way you always have it, okay? Just word to the wise, right? Now, I'll point out a little couple things about the deal, and just we'll kind of go through it and answer some of your questions a little bit. But basically, we have kind of the seller side, right? And this is based on a T12. And then I kind of have what my version is, or what I'm looking at in year one, what I'm going to do to it. And this is just my assumption tab. It's going to spit out, I'm going to hit my performer here in a minute. It's going to show you the calculations, because it doesn't really, is not the same thing as what we're doing here. But what I always say, I've got the seller side, and then I've got what I'm going to do. I'm not so much interested in what the seller really is. I just want to make sure it's true and accurate. I want to, as I get more data and more information, because would you agree that sometimes that sellers lie, right? Or the brokers, you know, when he comes up with this is pro forma numbers, right? So we never buy, we'd never want to underwrite on pro forma. We want to underwrite on a T12, and you want to have a current rent roll, right? So you have a rent roll and a current T12 is how we underwrite. And so what we did is we put all the numbers for the seller side. So like the total gross rents, if the property is fully rented up, 3,010, right? Physical vacancy, it's currently 7% vacant, right? And actually this was before this school season. So we went under contract, I think, in like June, right? So I'm getting ready to close in November. Like, that's how long this deal's lasted. Because I have an extension and I know how to write a contract, right? So, but we're getting ready to close. And so their side, and then, you know, $2.9 million. And then they have their numbers. And probably let me go to the pro forma, because I want to tell us, well, hold on, let me just give you a couple examples of what's going on. So they have their numbers, and then I kind of know how my management team and how we operate, right? So they're at $2,100 a door for salaries. I'm at $1,800. I believe in having, like, when I went there, I was like, dude, they got people just standing around not doing anything. And I want to have the correct amount of people. Management companies are very notorious. If you let them, they will figure out how to spend all your money. Okay? Your goal is to make sure you put that money in your pocket. So I'm a little bit more ninja, and I'm like, that budget ain't going to work for me, right? I'll make my management company put my budget in their budget. Like, I need to see it. And then if they're not hitting it, I'll be like, dude, what's up with this? We need to figure out how to get in the budget, right? So budgets are real important. Advertising and promotion, we're at 128,209. This, I think, is just and good management companies will be able to tell you a lot of their numbers, what they've seen in the industry. So I have kind of my idea of how we do things, but I'm also going to listen to my management company, because if they don't believe it, I'll never achieve it, right? I got to make sure that we get locked in and say, can we do this, and do you agree? And if they're like, I don't know, Corey, you know, if they don't just really get locked in, then I might need to adjust, right? Because I need to make sure that they believe in that number, because I'm going to hold them accountable to it, and I need them to really own it, right? And so sometimes you have to be a little bit flexible in what your is. But for us, $750 to spend $10,000 roughly a month for marketing for student housing is more than enough money to attract the right mom and dad tenants, right? Especially with pixels and like retargeting ads, and you can really like geo-target the college and get every kid that goes into that college and serve them up ads individually. Once you ping them, you pixel them, and then you can serve them cheaper ads down the road to say, come to Carolina Creek. So you can be really ninja with your marketing and dollar and ad spend than just blasting generic stuff out there, right? So that's kind of our approach, especially with the student housing space, is we can get really targeted into that space. Does that make sense? Okay. So maintenance, $1,200. Now, we have a budget to spend. You can't see this, but if you were to hover over these two tabs, I've got $1.6 million of money that the bank's going to give me for capital improvements that we're financing, and I'm also going to do another $684. So I've got like a $2.2 million capital improvement budget. I know from experience that when I fix a lot of the broken stuff, my normal maintenance cost should go down a little bit. So we've titrated it down to 205, right, instead of 256, because we're not going to have as much stuff breaking because we're replacing a lot of stuff. And a lot of that stuff's like appliances and things that are bigger ticket items. Okay? Office admin, we're about the same, a little bit more. Insurance is the same. Utilities and taxes are the same. Now, taxes was what a lot of people make mistakes on, by the way. Normally, taxes in your year one don't go up, but we have a place right here for your real estate tax growth in year two. And for this particular property in Virginia, we found that it doesn't get assessed until every 4 years. And it just got assessed. So we won't have a new tax assessment until 2024. So we're okay with that. So we still put some inflation. We said 5% in year growth and then a 3% growth. And it'll show up in my performance, but that's kind of our assumptions, right? And then we put in, so basically all this information right here is the seller's numbers. And then I have my numbers per bed or per unit. Now I do it per unit. I have different numbers in my, what I call your rules of thumb when it's non-student, right? So I have a version for students and a version for non-student, okay? So that's that column right there. This is just the column for all the property information, asking price, strike price. Strike price is what everything calculates from. Now, some other things about the property. So we're called reserves per door. That's like what the bank's going to give you that number, because the bank's going to make you hold a certain amount of reserves every month in their bank payment. And so that's where you put that dollar amount. We normally just keep it at 250, and then once we get it from the bank, we change it and update it. So this is version, it doesn't show you, it's version 4 on this calculator. Every time I have new iterations, I save the most updated version. So in my folder that I have for my calculator for this property, I'll have, as the versions go down, because I want to see what I did and what I changed as I went forward in the deal structure, right? So I can remember where we started and where we went and why. Yeah. Pardon me? Strike price is what the price that I'm going to buy it for, right? So I have asking price and then what I actually paid for it. This is the same because it was an off-market deal, so it's the same number. But a lot of times you have, here's what they're asking, and then you put what you might willing to go, what you're willing to go to. Trailing 12. Trailing 12, yes. Yeah, so the trailing 12 is just so when you're looking at financials, you're underwriting on a multifamily property, you want the P&L, the trailing 12, for the last 12 months of its operations. And so that's going to give you the totals for every category. Right? Yeah. I don't even know. But I'll hit a tab and find out. Yeah. So CapEx is an art. Okay? That's the factor that you gotta understand how it works. I will tell you that most people don't put enough CapEx money into their deals, right? I think we're probably almost like $12,000 a deal. And if I was to download this other document and show it to you, I could show you my budget. Like, we have a real budget. We went through every door in this property. We've assigned a dollar rehab amount for, appliance package, demo package. Like, we've assigned a value to everything, and we've done it for every building and every door, and we've totaled it up, and so that's how we got our $2.2 million budget. We didn't just pull it out of our butt and say, ooh, I think that's the number, right? We actually did the work, but initially we just kind of had an idea, And then as we get better iterations, we get more data, we're like, here's what it's going to really take. This is, and so we start building that pro forma because we want to make sure we're getting as close and accurate as possible. With me? Another question? Yep.
What's considered too long? What's considered an acceptable amount?
Because she's asking me about timing, right? So what's, you know, what's the timing look like? How long? So now I've had this probably under contract for almost 6 months,
okay.
Right?
Yeah,
yeah, but initially it was a phone call with the Chris. Here's the financials. Give me a couple weeks to underwrite it, right? So when we underwrite it, we take their all their real numbers that we have. We put them in there. Then we also run what's called CoStar reports, right? That's what we use in the commercial world, CoStar report. Now, if you don't have access to CoStar, find a broker that does. Ask them to run the report for your current property that you're looking for. They can do it. They can give it to you. It's really detailed. It'll show you all the comps and all the stuff, and you can really get a nice look and vision. Or even your property management company that you're working, thinking about working with will have CoStar as well. Now, we personally have CoStar, but I didn't when I started, right? But CoStar would be kind of like the MLS of commercial deals, right? So we had to initially look at this deal within 3 or 4 weeks and, like, come up and say, I think here's our LOI, our letter of intent. So we put together an LOI. Now, I have a rule for me, Corey Peterson. So we had this conversation. I was like, dude, this looks like it pencils. So the next step is to stop, drop, and make a plane purchase to fly to that market. I don't like to put LOIs on anything unless I've touched the ground, right? And why do I do it? And I'll tell you why. It's because then my offer means something, right? If I do sight unseen stuff, everybody knows that that's like, if I had two offers and you saw the property and the other guy didn't, I'm talking to the guy that saw it, right? So I just think it's really important. Now, so I spend a little extra money to go out. I don't do a bunch of, you know, multiple bid, like just bid, and put LOIs out. Some people teach that. This is just not my style. I just want my stuff to mean something. So if it meets, first it's got to meet my sniff test, meaning these numbers had to spit out profit. So let me just, and so when I first did this, this is not where we started, but so I didn't know about like this whole 14%. My normal thing says 4.64 or 3.63. And like this is a percentage of increase of your gross rents. Right? So if, you know, 3% of $800 or something like 720, I don't know what that number is, but what is that? Do the math. They help me. If I added something for $700 times 3%, it's $21, right? So that's a 3% increase on a $700 rent, right? And I think these are renting for $800, right? At $800 per bed, and so and they were getting $875 for the upgraded unit. So that's like a 3, 6, 9, 12 or 14% increase, right? So it was like, oh, okay. So what we saw on this property was when we actually did and got our boots on the ground and saw the property, because it would already look kind of like it looked like a deal, but we wanted to make sure that it was. When we get there, we see a very clear idea of what it is. 15% of the units are renovated. They're getting $75 more per bed. And we're like, oh, wow, that's pretty cool. And so what would it cost for us to renovate the existing 85% of the units? And then what does that look like if we do that rent? So all I did was I put 14% in year two. That's my increase for doing the lift, right? And when I do that, that's my big thing. And then I just, the rest of that, the regular 4%, which would normally be 3% in a normal market, but we're in an inflationary market, so I'm using a 4% growth model, right? Just for this particular market, for what I understand, what I know, right? It would normally be a 3% growth market for inflation, okay? We're saying that we're going from 7% vacancy to 6.66. I will never underwrite any more than a 6 or any better than 6% vacancy. Okay? Meaning 94% occupancy is the most, even if the property is 98, 99, I'll never underwrite to that number. And then 3% concessions. Now they're currently at 4, and I said I'm going to titrate it to 3. And that's just like they're giving too much weight to the college kids for like rent now, and I'll give you $100 off for like one-time concessions. And I hate concessions. And we find that if we run award-winning properties where we love on the kids and provide, you know, places for them to have fun and get to know their other roommates and stuff like that, we'll get that business because we're best in class, not because we're given something on because of a dollar. Right? That's my philosophy when I run students. Like we gotta be in the people business, and it takes a unique type of manager, but when done right, it's done well. All right. So are you with me there? So what kind of all the things that we've done? We said other income, that's like your laundry income, your utility or any fees, pet fees, application fees, that's other income. And then we have this utility reimbursement. Well, we call it RUBS, right? Residential Utility Bill Back System. That's like these kids just like spend money. Like they turn on the AC. I mean, we who all know this. Like your kids, they don't leave, turn all the lights off, right? 72, 65 on the AC, they'll immediately leave the door open, right? So we have a system that we give them a base electric spend. And if they go above it, then they have to split it within the roommates. And so we call that a utility bill back system. And it comes back. We've kept, you know, so it was at 16. We're going to bump it up to 18. And then in year 3, I'm going to bump it to 25. Right? And so what I've learned is kind of just keep it. And then like that third year after I've done all my renovations, I'll just shrink that utility allowance a little bit. Right? Just a little bit. You know, $5 per kid, that adds up real quick. Right, that creates more NOI, which makes the juice worth the squeeze. Right, makes your deal good. Right, so then now here's the real question. So there's all the data that we put in. Now, does it make any money? Okay, so let's click this one here. This is my favorite one, by the way. Hold on. We didn't go to the finance part. Sorry. Thank you. All right. Oh, and there's another thing that I want to show up, okay? So I just want to show off a little bit. Huh? Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah, this is the real deal. Like, this is not puff. This is the shit that I'm using. This is it. Okay, so, by the way, I'm getting a management fee of 3%. Corey Peterson takes an asset management fee of 2%, right there. That's my fee ongoing in the deal. And I didn't used to do this when I first started, but I realized that I have to, right? Because I'm going to have, like, when I've got operation costs with internally for, I got to have someone that answers my phones when my investors call. You know, I got divorced. I need to, my address changed. And if I don't want to take all that information, I got to have a team and some people. I got to be able to afford my staff, right? So you take an asset management fee. You absolutely do it. Everybody should. Okay? It's 2%. But I'm also taking a 3% acquisition fee because I'm setting up the deal. Now, sometimes that's 2%. Sometimes it's what you think you should be paid, which is the case on this one because, like, this is a great deal. And I'm going to get paid. So I said 3%. Now, what does that translate to? It's 3% of your purchase price, which is $697,000, right? That's pretty cool, right? So imagine doing 2 or 3 deals like this year. Why not? All day long, right? I just make money buying properties, right? Now, I have to raise the capital, all the money, to be able to get that fee. It's the last thing that I ever get. And as long as I fully raise my project, I do get paid, right? But it's a great fee because it does take a lot of work to get these deals. Right? I mean, it does. It takes a lot of work, there's a lot of game and, you know, connecting Voltron's hard, right? It's a lot of work to get it right. So when we do that though, so check, I gotta hit the button. And then the financing is 4% rate. 35% down because it's student housing. Right? So it's a lot more downstroke that we got to have. And it's interest only for, so it's actually interest, it's a 3-year bridge note with two 1-year renewals. So it's really a 5-year note in my vision. And I normally have a 5-year outlay or plan for underwriting. So that's I usually play for the long play. It's a 5-year plan. So, but all those years will be interest only. And so then we go into the cash flow model. So this is the one that I use to say, is it a deal or not a deal? Okay, let me see if, yeah, there we go. All right.
I'm sorry, do the numbers from the first sheet calculate into this one?
Yes, ma'am. Listen, the only place you can put in data is where there's a light blue. So I'm not telling you how long I took it with Google, and I mean, I Googled and Excel. I built this, most of it. Now, I've actually had a lot of good students and people come in, and I've kind of called it open source now, and so everybody comes in and brings, every time I get a good enough revision, I'm like, oh, that's great. And so we add it and update our software. But it is set up to where that first tab that I was in, that assumption page, is where probably 95% of the data goes. And I'm not going to hit every tab, but I just want to show you, I want to give you at least a deal to look at as we're kind of talking about underwriting a little bit and what I gave you guys for coming in. So the first part up here is the money, right? So this is where I titrate and I say, what am I going to give my capital? And so I have like year one, year two, year three plus. This is the pref that I'm going to give to investors. Now, I normally keep mine always at 6%. Have I done 7? Yes, one deal. Actually, I've done one deal at 8, which I never recommend, because 8's a hard number to reach. And that means you just don't make much cash flow on your end, your side. So I find that 6% pref is really the right, is a good pref to give investors. And what that means is they're going to get that money first before you can make any money. Okay? And then the percent to equity sell, that's the back end, right? And it's annualized for every year that they've been in the deal. And I'll scroll down here in a minute to show you, what it looks like if someone gives you $100,000, what that looks like. Now, also in my calculator, I also gave the ability to say, what if you meet those two metrics, right? And you want to give them some percentage of the upside after. So let's say I called it 6 and 12, which is 18% total return. But I wanted, after they hit 18%, maybe I give them 10% of the upside after, of every other dollar made. Right? So you could put 10% in this little spot here, and it would do that for you. Right? Now, I used to do that until I realized that I don't have to. So I'll teach you, this is my philosophy, okay? I owe my investors solid returns, and it's the returns that I can raise the capital for, okay? I just demonstrated there's millions of people out there making 6 to 8 in the stock market, so 12 is good. This one I'm doing 18, and this was one that I'm transferring a lot of my other investors, and it was a big raise, so I wanted to make it very attractive to get a lot of money quickly, okay? And so I gave up 18. But the answer for you is you got to do what it takes to get in your first deal. So that's kind of the right answer. But if you can titrate your money, he who has the lowest cost of capital always wins. Remember that. Like that's, you know, like China. I want to get China money. I want to get some money from China. I want some of that, like, you know, I want to get 4 or 3, you know, how do I get the REIT money? That's my goal. I'm going to keep challenging capital as I go, to see if I can keep lowering my cost of capital. And why? Because I'm an operator. I have a good track record, and that track record has some value. Does that make sense? Someone had a question. No? Okay, yeah. Yeah, I do. Yeah. Because I find that most of my investors want a paycheck, and I love giving them that paycheck. Man, that's the best way to solidify a new investor, is you give them money. Like, they give you money, you know, 3 or 4 months, 6 months into the deal, they get their first check, boom, they're in. They're like, dude, this is awesome.
So you use that more as well as a selling tool to your investors?
Yeah, yeah. And I know my demographics. I know that most of them are closer to retirement. They want to see income. Income's their main driver. I'm selling income from everything I've taught you from the first half of today, was I've based everything on income. So I'm just going to keep true to my message and say that that is what I am. I'm an income product, right, through real estate that provides steady cash flow that they can depend on. And then we give them a back end when we sell. Right, so that seems to be a nice recipe for a lot of the capital that's out there. They want to make some money now. They like the back end later, but that budget of getting them nice paychecks is what I think they're most interested in. Okay, so the way this deal breaks out is, so it's a $10.5 million raise. My year one NOI is 1.5. Then I have my yield to equity. So that yield to equity is that 6%. So to pay $10.5 million, a 6% pref, it takes $630,000 a year to do that. So I've subtracted that. Then I have my debt service, my note, my payment to the bank, 670. Then I have that CapEx reserve, right? That number that I got to give the bank every year. They do it every month. They take it every month on top of my payment to have money for fixing stuff up. And what's left over is that beautiful thing called cash flow, right? So $234,000, right? Is that pretty cool, right? Guess where that goes? Hip Pocket National Bank, right? That's daddy's money, right? And that's a great number. Now, let's say I've got partners, which I do in this deal. This is me playing around. I think I got 75% ownership of it, but I'm giving 25% of it away. Right, so that guy is making, he's going to make 2.1. So here's the best part, too, is when we sell, so we're making cash flow all along the way. And this is a selling point when I actually have my performance, I'm showing my investors. I'll show them, hey, listen, I'm making $234,000 after I've paid you guys' money. And here's why it's important that you want me to make a lot of money. Because the question we should be asking ourselves is, what if you don't hit your numbers? What happens? Right? And I want to be able to say, listen, I got $234,000 of my money to give up to make sure that you're whole. See, that preface means I don't get any of this money unless you get fully whole. And people are like, oh, okay, I get it. That's what that preface means. I don't get paid till you get paid. And I think it's important to let your investors see that and know it. And that should give them a nice little sense of security. Now, in some deals, that doesn't happen until year two or three, because if you have a big value play where you're going to come in and go through a really beaten down property and you're going to do a really big lift and change things up, you may go year one or two without any income. Well, if that's the case, you can always titrate those first two numbers for the pref to zero. Hey, look, there's no pref because there's no profit. We're not going to strap ourselves just to make a payment to you. We got to do the work, and then it starts to pay. And as long as the numbers, come out at the end, which it should, if you're doing a real big lift like that, your value at the end is going to be huge. So you just got to have to titrate it to make it work that way. So does that make sense for everybody? All right. So at the end of the day, we sell the property for $41 million. That's the goal. Now, here's the truth. I already know this. I'll probably sell this property. I know it's going to be more for 41. It's probably going to be more 50, 52, or something like that. I got a feeling that that's what, because I think inflation is real right now. And we've been fairly conservative in our underwriting and our cost. And I think our income line is going to go up more than we expect. Right? But if it doesn't, or if our costs go more than we expect, I have enough cushion that I feel very comfortable. In year three, I'm making $751,000. I'm actually making more than my pref now, right? And it's beautiful. I told you that's that curve. As you raise rents for student housing, it really goes up that way. I feel like, right? Because my costs don't go up that exponentially. But so at the end of the day, we'll make $10.8 million profit on this project, and I think it'll be closer to $20 million. Yeah. So, yes. Okay, so let me show you. Here's where the magic happens. Okay, so this is my goal on every project when I set one up. Okay, I believe now I have what's called a buyout option in every PPM that I create, right? It's called a call option. I can call every investor whenever I want, and I just got to do it legally, right? I just got to write the form, and we're going to. But I can refi this price. So in year five, I'm absolutely, probably in year three, like we'll get this done in year three, I think. It may take us one more year, but by year four, we're doing it. We're going to refi into a Freddie Mac loan, because I'm in a bridge note, which my rate's a little higher, right? I'll refi into a Freddie Mac loan, get like 5 years interest only. I'll put it on a 10-year, 15-year note. I'll cash out all my investors and buy them out, take them completely out the deal, own it with just me, myself, and the partners that are in my B-share. And that's where it gets really good, right? What happens when I do that? Replace 18% money with 3% money, right? I get to make the delta in between, and we hold it for another, and I usually say I'll hold it for another 5 years and then see where I'm at, right? Maybe it's time to hit the play. Now, the only reason you sell something like that is if you can make more income, right? So that's, in my mind, so I'm selling my property, the Palms. I bought it for $9 million, selling it for $19 million. The only reason I'm selling it at a 4 cap. It's a ridiculous amount of money. But the reason I'm selling it is because I'm buying this deal. And a lot of my money is going to go into this deal, so I'm okay with it. Right? But that's the only reason I'd sell in my mind. Or if you needed to get liquid for any reason. Like sometimes you got to have liquidity. Right? So if I ever felt like I was getting tight, then you sell something. But my goal is to always keep them, especially on a product that's like 2010. Like, that's one I could hold for the next 40, 50 years and be great.
Do you typically take into account appreciation,
or that's your icing on the cake, like at 41, 50? Yeah, well, that is my appreciation of, so I've built appreciation in here. That would be cap rate. So we would call that cap rate, maybe a little bit. But I've already figured out, so I've built a model that I feel is a conservative model. I think it will get better from here. That's why I think it'll probably sell. Now, and if cap rates keep compressing, but cap rates could go the other way, right? And that's the real risk that I'm taking. But whether or not cap rates go anywhere, this is what I want to make really clear to everybody. I'm not buying this property based on anything else other than the sexy cash flow, right? I give two shits about what happens at the end. I really don't care, right? I'm in it for the cash flow. I'm a cash flow guy. That I like to buy them and hold them, right? And so I'll sell it when it makes sense, right? If the market's right, I'll sell it. But I'll be able to run this property, at the very least be able to get my investors out of it and own it with me and my small group. And then we'll figure out what we do from there, but we'll only sell it when it makes sense. No. I've thought about it, and then I slap myself. My wife says, don't ever do that. No, I have the same management company nationally for all my properties. So my management company is called Asset Living. They're based out of Houston. They're a great company. They do a lot of student is their primary business, but they've also, like, they have 150,000 beds. They also have 100,000 just regular multifamily units. So they manage all my stuff, and they've done a phenomenal job. Yeah, and actually I have a construction manager too. So I have a separate construction management team that I use, and that's usually who goes on the due diligence sites with me. I'm more interested about, like, how much does it cost to fix? And I want that guy with me to, like, figure that out, right? But if you don't have that guy, you can ask your potential management company to come with and bring that guy. Because they'll have somebody on their team that they could do that. And some, on the initial site visit, they might do that as a pro bono. When you do your due diligence, they're going to want to have a fee. Sorry. They're going to want to have a fee normally to go and walk each and every unit. Does that make sense? This is totally off the cuff. I just put these slides in here because I wanted to show you guys like kind of a real working deal that I'm doing. And so as I scroll down to this is the other part that I set up. So I want to know, like, if my investors, you know, what does it look like if they gave me $100,000, right? It's $6,000 a year. We pay quarterly, so that's $1,500 a quarter. And then year one, year two, year three, year four, and then year five, they're going to make another $60,000, right? So they would have made $30,000 in payments and $60,000 at the back end. So they would have made $90,000, which is 18% return. Okay, so that's usually enough for a lot of people to be like, oh, pretty, that's pretty cool. Now, the only question I get a lot of times, they're like, but that's not compounded. Right? They're like, well, that's not really you're not compounding your money. And so I always say, this is my answer to that. Well, here's what we can do is, you know, I don't want to do it for every 1 year, but like every 2 years you get $12,000 if you're a repeat customer. So usually my minimum is $100,000. But for people that are in deals with me, and they say, hey, Corey, I got $12,000 in that same IRA account that you've given me. Can you reinvest it in another deal? So we'll do that for them, right? So because I want to keep their money working as best I can. I don't want to just sit in their self-directed account with zero money, right? So that's the way to do it. And here's the best part, and I'll get your question here in a second, is that, but at least at every 5 years, they can reinvest the 60, and if they've saved their checks, right? Now that's $90,000. They can come into another deal. And so at least every 5 years, they have an opportunity to get what I call a COLA. Now, older people understand what COLA is, cost of living adjustment, right? In your money, right? Because inflation is real. And old people who are close to retirement, they understand that cost of living is the killer, right? I mean, look at where we're in right now. Gas, inflation, everything's going up. And so the people that have that money, it's got to earn more or they got to keep up with it. It's going to go away. So does that make sense? Question back there. How do I adjust my risk? Yeah. I just account for the risk in what my underwriting, like what my assumptions are, right? So the cost of money for me is the cost of money, right? Now there is a opportunity risk for the purpose of that person that's investing in my sale, like do they invest in my deal or do they invest in another deal, right? But I try to run the risk that I run is in my performa, and I didn't hit the performa page, but like I would then just tell the story of here's where, you know, based on the assumptions that we made, is how accurately can I hit those assumptions? And so when I hit my performa page, it tells the story. I'm sorry. Of kind of the financial picture, and it's got to make somewhat sense. If it looks like people can tell if you're speeding or if you don't have a history of this, so I can show them other deals. And then my biggest thing is also, once you start doing this business and you start getting into some investors, you're going to find that you have people that love you and would love to tell other people. So I've got a group of about 6 or 7 investors that are, you know, I'm like, can I refer you? Do you mind if you refer me? They're like, yeah, okay. So when I have new investors, I say, hey, don't take my word for it. Like, just go call the money. Just call it, because money never lies, honestly. Money's going to tell the exact truth. That's what I found. And my girls, I say they're girls, most of them are girls, women. Because COVID's real. Like, I went through COVID. I have student housing. Last year sucked ass. It was really tough. Right? But we got through it. But I communicated with my investors. We had to suspend some payments. Right? I mean, it was a real deal. Now we're back, we're doing well. Like, this new school year, like, it rebounded quickly. Right? Because the need for kids to get out of mom and dad's house is strong, right? And so it rebounded fairly quickly. And so I think that was, but my investors will tell that story. And they'll tell it with very genuine, you know, like, but I know that I can trust Corey. I know that, you know, he's communicated with us all the way through. And so that's a great, who underwrites for COVID? Nobody, right? But it happened. But, you know, the whole industry, by the way, it did well. Right, even our, like, for rentals. We all know this, like, but we all did pretty well. None of us got killed. Oh, there's another question over here. How do I what? As soon as I can take them out, take them out. Always, amen. So I just got to hit them and make their bucket hit. So the way I've done my setup, right? This is what I do a little bit differently than everybody else. Okay, I define in my ownership setup. It's usually a 50-50 split. Now, we don't do 70-30 splits, it's a 50-50% ownership split, but then I define the payout, and I deal in absolutes. It's 6 and 6, or 6 and 12, which is 18%. Once they get a total return of 18%, I have hit the threshold. It doesn't matter what the property is worth. I have fulfilled my... I've done exactly what I've said. I can call them and call that option. So I don't do that call option until I get to that point, right? Because the way my PPM is structured, it's a pref on the front, and it's a pref on that sell point. Like that back end, before I can make any of the back end money, I have to make my investor, I got to fill them all the way to that 12% for every year that they've held it, right? So I give up all the front on both sides. So then if I do crush it, I get it on the back end, but my investors are okay with that, right? Because they're getting first dibs of all the profits, and that makes sense in their eyes. Yeah. Yeah, that is a great news. I forgot to tell. So I pointed out, like, it was 14% growth in year two that I put for this deal. But that's not the real percentage. It's going to be more like 25, but there's no way I'm putting 25 in that deal. It would never happen. So, because we'll go back to the actual presentation now. Okay, sorry. Yeah. All right, let's see if it works. Okay. Wrong presentation. And this is why. Hold on. There we go. Corey has to sleep like a baby. Okay? I'm telling you, this is real. I'm going to tell you a pain story, okay? Am I perfect? No way. Have I lost investors' money? Almost. Pretty damn close, right? My second deal that I did, I told you the great first one, I made a lot of money on it. My second deal, I bought a little smaller property than I should have. It was 72 units. It was in Tucson, which I'm from Phoenix, so it's an hour and a half away. But I made my first mistake. I hired a regional management company out of Atlanta that was managing my deal that I was so good at, to manage the one in Tucson, and they weren't set up. They couldn't really do it very well, and they started falling behind. And so they failed. And so then I was like, well, I'm smart. I'm going to self-manage it. Get on it. And that was a horrible train wreck. I made a lot of mistakes. I learned how you can get a fair housing complaint put on you, and I didn't do anything, but, you know, I said I was making racial remarks. And it was coming to me, right? They were calling me cracker, all kinds of things, man. White bread. But I got the fair housing complaint, right? And I just realized, so 2 years of that, I finally called a local management company called MEB, and within 3 months they fixed the whole thing. But this was 2 years later, right? And I'm going to tell you, those 2 years of having calls with investors, and to have to own up to all of it, because I had to own it. It was hard. It was not fun. And I'll never forget it, like having those calls. Now, the truth is, I wish I would have had the balls to say we're staying the course, because I could have made them. But they all wanted to sell. Because once I had it fixed, it was like, oh, we finally got it fixed. It's going to work itself out. And if we would have held it another 3 years in the Tucson market, gosh dang it, we would have been so happy. But we didn't. We sold. And I sold it for almost what I paid for it. I ended up having to come up $150,000 to make all my investors whole. So they didn't make any interest. They just got their principal back. But for me, that was 2 years of stress in my life. And I realized from that point that I do want to underwrite more conservatively. I want to make sure. And it was a great lesson to have early on to realize that, I'm telling you, when I talked about that other slide, I'll be conservative in underwriting. You've got to sleep like a baby. When you raise, could you imagine $22 million what we're going to raise this year? And having the weight of that on you, listen, that's how people go off, I think. That amount of stress, if you were to really screw stuff up and do it and hit on the gas pedal. So it pays to be conservative. It is okay. Some of the best deals you'll ever do are the ones you'd never do. And I'm okay with that, right? Amen? Mm-hmm. Amen, right? Because that's the money. Integrity, you said it earlier, you get one shot at integrity. Now, those investors, half of them were new. I'll never see them again. Never. The other half, luckily, had been in multiple deals with me, and they said, Corey, where's your next deal? Yeah, we'll gladly put our money in. And they did, right? But you get one shot at new people. You really do. And that one shot, especially when you're new coming out, you've got to have the best shot. Right? And you just got to do what you say you're going to do and work your business like you want to. Okay? All right. So sorry to go off on a tangent, but I thought that would be a good place to kind of have a real life world example of a deal. Right? So is that cool?
Yeah.
All right. Cool. Okay. So let's see where we're at. So we don't even have to go through this one because I just went for the whole thing. So we don't have to take it. Do we all want to take a break? Quick break? Yeah. Yeah? All right, so let's take a 10-minute break, okay? At 15 after, we're going to come back, okay? Let's take a break. Thank you, guys. Yeah. Cool deal.
You said you'd use something for a CRM. What do you use?
So I use ActiveCampaign. Hi, guys. Let's get back. Oh, yeah. Someone took my marketing flyer.
I just said you didn't have your assistant here. So. You talked so much about the stationery. I am like, I'm all about it. Thank you. Do you want me to pass this around?
This is different, but yeah, that's, I don't know where my... bring it back in. Cowbell.
I don't want to miss one juicy morsel.
Yeah, I am. I won't have much of a voice left, but I'll become. I'll find my. Yeah, put stuff around. All right, come on in, babies. Let's get her. I've got to find my clicker. Got my water. Yep. All right, are we having fun so far? I mean, it's pretty cool, right? You guys are being a great audience, by the way, asking lots of questions. It's becoming more and more interactive, and I like that. I think that's how we all learn. So thank you for taking the time and voicing your opinions and coming up with questions. I think that makes it way better for everybody that's in the audience and keeps us awake, right? Because it's hard to stay here all damn day. It's hard enough for me to talk all damn day. But to be on the other side, and trust me, I am a seminar junkie. I've been to more seminars than I ever want to know, tell anybody about. But I learned something, and I always say if I can just learn one or two things that really move my needle, then it was all worth it. And so thank you for giving me your time. I just want to make sure I say that from the bottom of my heart. Really appreciate that. Okay, so a couple little housekeeping items. And I'm just going to say it now, just in case any of you cats got to leave early, okay? At the end of this thing, I'm going to give away what I call the Kahuna Boardroom, which is a three-day intensive of how I'm teaching today, but in way more detail. And if this is, I think I've been pretty good at, you know, sharing a lot of stuff, and we don't have a whole lot of time for me to do it, but, like, we deep dive in that cash flow calculator. We have multiple... ways to do it. We have a 5-week every week before we start 8 weeks before the event starts, and it's in April 21st through the 23rd. It's in Scottsdale, Arizona. It's $14.97. It's a 3-day. You get my all online course, and I'm going to pitch it later on. But if anybody has to leave early, I just don't want you to miss out. And I'm just going to tell you. This is the last event that I'll ever teach, okay? And the reason I say that is I love teaching. I really love it, right? The problem is my company is a real estate company. I do real estate. That's where I make the most of my money. And my team, we came up this year as we set our goals and our dreams and where we're going to, and our vision for our company. There's not enough room for the teaching platform. It has to go, right? So this is going to be my last teaching event, and I'm telling you, I give it all away. I normally charge $5,000 for it. It's a 3-day intensive. You get, like, I don't know where it went off to. Someone grabbed it, but that's okay. April 21st through the 23rd. They have information in the back. You can sign up for it in the back. I'll talk about it more later and when we get towards the end of this. But for anybody that needs to leave, and if you know you, that's something of interest to you, talk to the guys in the back. You want to raise up your hand there, bro? Right there? Yep. They'll be able to help you. And I'm just going to tell you, it'll probably be the best investment you'll ever make. I just know that because I'm not saying that I'm the master teacher, but I'm telling you that I can teach it in a way that most people understand it. Right, and that you can put it to work. Because I've seen a lot of students, I've had a lot of successful students do their first deal, and it's such a rewarding position for me to watch and see that. So, but it is going to be my last event that I'll ever do, just because I'm a real estate guy first. That's what I love. I love finding deals. I enjoy teaching. I have a podcast, right? Multifamily Legacy Podcast. I teach, I've written a couple books and things like that, and we have a mastermind. So the mastermind is really, I'm keeping my mastermind, I really enjoy that. But But we're going to stop teaching as much. And we may have one or twice a year that we do, well, just one if we ever, my wife would, she would not want me to do it. She wants me home, so. But anyways, I say that because I really am passionate about it. And I tell you that anybody that's went to it, it's white glove. We actually pay for lunch and dinner, right? Like we, you know, there's one, we do a luau. Like, listen, you can't be have a big kahuna event and not do a luau. So we do a luau, right? We got great dancers and we do the haka. And it's a lot of fun, but it's a lot of good information. So if you like what this is just the tip, right? This is just a piece of it that I've had to cram in just for you guys to give as much as I can in the deal. And the other part of that is what I really offer is deal partnering, you know, and access, right? Everybody, and it's only for 60 people. So there's no more than 60 people ever in that room because I can't educate and teach and give time to more than that. And that's just the way I've decided to do it. I'm not a one to many. I'm a one to few. And those few I want to know. I want people that I like, know, like, and trust, and that want to grow. And those are the people that I want to put in my boardroom. So if that's that you, go in the back. Would love to have you. Don't have to do it now. Just know that it's there. If you have to leave early, I just want to make sure that you didn't miss out on it if you had to. Okay? All right. Cool. Okay. Here we go. So if you think about what we've covered a little bit so far, we started off with, you know, finding the money, right? We've scratched it decently. I think we did a decent job on the money. I missed this part. I wanted to talk about one little story before I get here. Remember when we talked about, like, finding the deal, like, and meeting the broker and going into it, you know, and having lunch with them? So I had two students that did I tell that story? Okay. So, and this is recently. This is the deal that I closed in July. So they're students of mine. They're in my mastermind. They were going, so my mastermind event was in Phoenix. And so they were like, they're one of the markets, Tucson. So they go 2 days early to Tucson. And they're like, we're just going to go in and meet the brokers, right? And they used my methodology. They found the right brokers in the list. And they set up some breakfast and lunch appointments. So they meet this guy. And I actually gave them a very specific referral for this broker. So I actually had my broker, my lender broker, my mortgage broker, facilitate the exchange because he's a Berkadia mortgage broker, and he gave a Berkadia brokerage broker for finding multifamily deals. And so they made the bridge to this guy in this market. So my students go there, meet lunch, they have lunch or they have breakfast, and all they do is talk about the broker, whatever the broker, he likes Corvettes, he's the golf guy, and they, you know, just all about him. And that's what he is, just all about him. He's really cool, really nice guy, but they did what I told them, which is don't talk about you, be professional, and you know, and these guys were good, they understood, like you. They were doing single family fix and flip. They know their business. They're not broke, and, you know, they had a little bit of wherewithal. So they just go out and they meet the guy. So he's like, hey, listen, let's meet this afternoon. I got a deal that I want to show you. And he actually brought a deal to the breakfast, right? So the deal and the breakfast wasn't really what they were looking for. So they meet for after lunch, and they go look at a deal, and that deal is not really, it's like wrong part of town. But he had a deal that he just got under contract in his hand, and he brought it. And it really wasn't even inked yet. And so he gives it to my students, and he goes, "Here's the deal that I think I got. It's a 96 unit deal in Tucson." So they come to my event, and we're like, "Well, let's underwrite it." So we underwrite it right there, live, with all my team. I was like, "Oh my God, this is a deal, right?" And I was like, "Dude, let's get the guy on the phone," and we close the deal right there, right? Or at least, you know, and it was one of those. It was off market, and you know. We had to go some earnest money hard, and they were all scared. And I was like, listen, I'll partner with you guys on this. This makes sense, right? So we did a partnership right there. And anyways, we closed on that deal in July, and we're crushing it, right? And it's another rehab play where we're going to spend about $870,000 in renovations, and it's going to do well. Now, what we didn't know is how well the market, like, that was, we were under contract in January. And I'm telling you, like, from January to now, the market's, like, really taken off. And so we're smiling from ear to ear. Like, it's a great deal. So someone asked, can you still get off-market deals in times like this? And the answer is yes, all the time. All the time, twice on Sundays. But you got to put yourself in position, right? So it's all about positioning yourself to win. And when you do it right, I think it really works really well. All right, so what we're going to talk about now is kind of the process of, you know, looking at deals to going under contract and everything that can happen in between, right? Because I don't think everybody understands truly all the stuff that happens in the deal. So I'm going to kind of give you a, we're going to pull back the curtain a little bit and kind of look at all the steps that happen, who you got to notify, what does it cost, right? Like the real stuff that no one talks about, okay? Is that cool? All right, here we go. So it all starts with this little cash flow calculator, right? That's the little zip drive. That's the deal that does the underwriting template and that we just looked at earlier, that you've got to kiss the frogs. You got to do the underwriting. Now, most of the time you do the underwriting, it's like, not a deal, right? Not a deal. Not, but it's coming in here and you're saying, is it a deal? No. No, it's a dead deal. It goes to the boneyard, right? But occasionally you've got one that initially from your underwriting looks like it has potential, right? It's a yes. Like, I think this looks like a deal, right? So the next step is you go do a site visit, right? So that's, now, other people teach you go write an offer. I don't believe that's the right way. Not if you want your offer to have value, right? So I believe this is where you have to spend a little bit of money. Now, there's a red dot. It means we're going to spend real money, right? Because you're going to have to go, if that's not your market, you're driving to it or flying to it, got a hotel stay, right? It's probably going to cost you about $1,500, maybe a little less, right? And if you're good at it, but, you know, you're going to buy a ticket with not much time to go, and it's going to cost you a little money, right? But you do it, because that's what you've got to do in this business. This is some, and if you can't, then you've got to be resourceful and find someone that can, right? Maybe it's, hey, can I get my management company that's in that area to go do that site visit for you, right? That's being resourceful. And they can be your liaison, and that works too. But I personally, and if I was you and knew, I'd want to do this on my own. Okay? Go see that property. Now, the site visit is really interesting to see what happens at site visits. Because here's what I think happens a lot of times. So when you're doing a site visit, you come with the broker shows up, and I swear to God, it's kind of like they say, right this way. And they only want you, and they're like, hold on, don't look, right? Okay, you know, and they're just putting you in all the stuff, like they only want to see you certain things. And so I went to a property one time with some friends, and this deal was not a deal, right? It truly wasn't a deal, and I knew it wasn't a deal. But they wanted to go through the process, and I was like, we're wasting our time, guys. But so we show up, and we get out of the car, dude, and it was like, the manager, the broker, and then two guys, and they got the key box, and they're like, hey, what's going on? And it's like, okay, let's go look at the deals. Let's go look at the units. Let's show you some units. And, like, that's not my process, right? My new guys, I call them F&Gs, the freaking new guys, right? The F&Gs were like, oh, yeah, hey, and they're shaking their hands. How's it going? And they're all talking, and so I was like, hey, is the manager here? They're like, yeah, she's inside. I was like, oh, great. So I just keep walking, and so I just, they're all just out in the back over there, and I'm already going to the management deal, and I just sit down, and they, like, after about 5-10 minutes, I think they realize that I'm not there, but I'm sitting down with the manager, and I'm just like, so tell me about your property, because at the site visit, there's a couple people that I really want to get to know. And that's your head maintenance guy and the property manager. They know, like, where's Waldo? Okay? There's a Waldo. There's multiple Waldos at every property. Your goal is to find them. Now, everybody that's at the property already knows where they're at. But they won't tell you unless you ask them the right questions, right? And so one of the best ways to get them to really share is to get the broker, just let the broker know that you're going to be here for a long time. And I don't think you're going to want to spend all that time with me, so it's okay if you need to check out. I know you got other appointments, right? Catch you later. I want him to check out, because once I kick him to the curb, everybody sings like canaries, right? So, but to continue the story, so like this property that we look at, I already know it's not a deal. My underwriting doesn't say it's a deal, but I'm just doing it because I got some students, and they were just convinced this thing could work. And I'm like, guys, it's not going to work. But we had to go through it, so they had to see it, right? And they're just all wide-eyed. Oh, man, we're at a property. You know, and I was like, oh, we're just wasting our time. I'm talking with the girl, this manager. She's been a manager for like 15 years, right? And I was like, oh, and but the problem with the property is like it had really bad occupancy. It was like 82%. It's really low, and it like has been 82 for a long time. And then there's like the stepchild, like little, like 15 units down the street around the corner, and it's like, it's the redheaded stepchild, like it gets no love, and it's just, it's bad, and it'll never be good, because it's sight unseen, and no one's going to manage it. So they got that thing, and so I'm talking to her, and I was like, so, you know, Gina, her name was Gina, and I was like, Gina, so how long have you been at the property? Been here 15 years. Know the owner? No, she's proud. Proud Mary. And I said, now, I'm curious. I'm trying to figure out what the problem is. And, you know, like, what's the best this property's ever, what's the best you've ever had it at? 83%. And I was like, and now we're going through this interrogation a little bit, or like we're having conversation. I'm sorry. But it felt like interrogation from my point of view. I'm talking to her. And so all of a sudden now here comes the paparazzi, right? They're all showing up, and they're all realizing that we're having a real conversation. I got my notepad. I'm like playing, my legs crossed, and I'm right taking notes, and she's making comments. And I'm just asking questions, but I'm trying to get them to own it, right? The 82%, like, you got to own that. Like, come on, Gina, 82%. So what's the problem? I'm like, Gina, what's the problem, right? And everybody's starting to get uncomfortable a little bit, right? You can just see everybody starting to squirm, like, because they all want to be there for the show, I guess. And, you know, I wasn't ready to go look at properties. I want to get to some of the root causes and just see what they really think. And then there's this little thing that I do. I call it the magic wand, right? So you say, take the magic wand, and I say, you know what? Here you go. Here's the magic wand. You got to grab it. Yep. Say, now you got it. Okay? And I say, Gina, listen, this is the magic wand. You got it. I say, now, this magic wand does a lot of cool things, and if you wave it around, it will fix anything that your heart desires within this property, right? What are the first three things that you'd want to fix, right? What would you change about the property? And, dude, it's the greatest trick, right? And they'll start saying, you know, and they start talking about the problems that they're not supposed to talk about, but because I gave them a magic wand, damn it, they do it. And this magic wand is crazy, because then I say, all right, give it back. Because she'll stop. She won't stop talking. She wants to use it all day. I take it back from her, right? And then I look at the maintenance man. I go, okay. I give it to the maintenance man. And I go, here you go. Here's the magic wand, the maintenance guy, right? I said, now, you're same thing for you, with the exception that we don't fix ACs. It doesn't do that. Right? Because every maintenance guy, this is supposed to be funny, every maintenance guy, his first thing is, I just want the ACs to work. No, you got to work on those things till they die. That's your job. Okay? It doesn't fix AC, but it can fix everything else. And then you tell me the right thing, right? Tell me the stuff. And then he sings like a canary. And I take it back from him. I was like, anybody else want the wand? You know? And it's a neat tool. And then I usually try to take them out to lunch. But so I'm talking with Gina. I'm getting some more conversations going, and finally I was like, so Gina, like, you know, do you think this property can even get to 95%? She's all, hell no. Right? I don't think we got enough people that want to rent this place. Right? And it was like, And I go, and I'm like, I shut my deal and I go, and that says everything. So I think we're done here, right? And so they're like, well, do you want to look at the units? I was like, no, I don't think we want to look at the units. Now, the two FNGs, you know, they were, yeah, let's go look at the units. And so I'm sitting out there. So now they go, but the broker, the real broker is with me. He's standing by me because he realized that I'm not going to con him. He thought we were suckers. And then I'd come in there like, no, we ain't suckers, bro. And he's like, well, and dude, he starts, well, I know the owner. I've known him for 20 years, and he told me to come out here. So I kind of had to do it. I had to come out here, and, you know, and I know it's not a deal at this price. You know, it's way too much. But it's interesting to see how when you get real with people and asking the right questions, and really that's the whole goal of a site visit, is to get as much information about a property as you can. You're really trying to evaluate that cash flow calculator that you filled out. You're really trying to look and say, are those numbers accurate or do I need to make changes? That's the whole reason of a site visit. It's a good thing to meet the broker, but you're on a mission from God, right? To go make sure that you owe it to your investors as you're starting your investigation process to make sure that you're going to find a deal, that it's going to do what it says, and that you're going to protect them by doing the due diligence early on and start asking the right questions and going taking, you know, let that broker get out of the way. If you still like that property, it wasn't a deal killer, you go in there and take that manager and, you know, to lunch, or the, you know, the maintenance guy to lunch. It's very interesting if you go there 2 days in a row and you take one for lunch and then the other for lunch. Because what will happen, they'll tell on each other. I mean, they really will. Because they're, like, at the end of the day, they already know they're interviewing for what? A job. We're probably not going to keep any of them. But a lot of properties we do. Like, we do keep staff a lot of times, right? Not every time. And they all have to go to a certain level and raise to what we think they can do, or we got to find new people. But the people business right now is actually really hard. We all know this across the board. Right? It's hard to find people. So it's way more advantageous if we can train them up. We can. We'll try. We'll give them everybody that opportunity. But it doesn't always pan out. Okay? So, but that's what that site visit is made to do, is to go gather intel. Now, one of the best things you'll ever do on a site visit is walk on the back side of a building. Okay? Very important. Walk on the back side. Write that down. Walk around the back side of the building. Because that front facade is bueno. And you go around the back and you're like, oh, this is where they hide the bodies. Right? Because it can get real sketch in the back. And I don't know why, but it's just like every maintenance guy, as long as that front looks good, but you go around the corner and you're just like, whoa, this is Jurassic Park back here. Right? And so, you can use that to your advantage. Now, part of the site visit and actually your due diligence is you got to realize that most owners, and I'm just like this as well, they come to their properties once or twice a year. I don't really know what the hell's going on with my properties. I think I do because I have meetings, but I don't know what's going on with my properties until I visit them, and I try to do a good, you know, I visit at least twice a year. But the truth is, I don't know. And my goal when I'm doing site visits and when I get my due diligence is I'm going to know more about that property than that seller does. Because he probably doesn't know about, like, one property we went and inspected the roofs, and someone on the top floor was taking their dirty-ass diapers and throwing it like this, just throwing it, I mean, just mounds of them. And so we took photos. Do you know that you got this? Right? What else is there, you know? And because it's kind of like the, you know, it's kind of like dealing with the cops, which you say can and will be held against you. That's exactly what we're doing at these site visits. We're documenting everything that we can, taking an extreme amount of pictures of everything. Interiors, exteriors, right? We're building up our database. And then we got to go back. Once we've completed that site visit, now we got to go back and inform our cash flow calculator, Right? Because we may have said, oh God, we budgeted $4,000 a door in capital improvements, but really, this thing needs, you know, a slurry restripe and it's going to need roofs. Because you can't always see roofs. So you're like, oh, these are going to need roofs. That's $400,000. And you start doing the math, like, that's another $3,000 a door. Right? So even though we talk about it by the door, you try to want to, like, this is what a good management company will help you do if you're new, was determine the cost. And you can kind of route it in per door, per cost per door. So that's what we talk about it in the industry is per door. But it's good to have a real cost of what it all costs. Right? A good idea. Now, on the site visit, we're just going to look at a couple of one of each floor plan. And I want to see if they'll let me see any down units. So down units are ones that are, there's major things wrong. You know, like it can't, it's not rentable right now. And so, like, I want to try to get in every down unit and one of each floor plan. And then I'm going to tour the property. Then I'm also going to go tour the comps. I'm going to go look at all my comp sets that I have. So I'm going to go hit all those other apartments, and I'm going to act like I'm there to rent. They'll know that it's probably I'm shopping them, but they don't, you know, whatever. I want to go see the properties. I want to see what they look like. I want to see if they're charging more or less. And because I'm building my profile of what I got to do to my property and how I'm going to prove it and what rents can I get, what rents can I expect. Does that make sense? All right, so that's going back and informing your calculator. Now, you come back too and adjust your income. Like, wow, I really see that we could push rents based on this comp set. If we do this, then I can get even more for my rents too. So, you know, you kind of build your calculator with that more better informed data. Okay, now, so at that point, though, you come back and inform it, and the numbers are going to either work or not. Sometimes we went on a site visit, we're like, oh, like that one that I already knew wasn't a deal, but when I got there and I saw that it was a broken, really like 20 units that are on the side, I just don't do broken complexes normally. So I was like, that's a deal killer right away. But I've also went on one that I thought was a deal, and it was great, looked great. But then there's this, I get there, and there's this convenience store right next to it, like the 7-Eleven. And I'm watching, I go to do a night audit, and I just see foot traffic. Man, a lot of people walking. And to me, that's a bad sign. Bad sign. Right? Because foot traffic, like, I want people going into bed and going home, going to sleep. If there's foot traffic, everybody's walking, that means they ain't got jobs. Or, you know, I think we saw a drug deal when we walked in, so. Yeah, it was like, no, this is an absolute no-go. Now, if it would have been, like, there's a property right across the street that was fully fenced and had a gate. I was like, oh, probably maybe bought that property, but not this one. So sometimes you don't see that when you're there. So there's things that can just go there, and you're like, ugh, not a deal. Right? And that's going to happen. Like, this is what I see a lot of times. People go, and they're like, oh, it's a deal, and they'll convince their way that it's a deal. And I'm just going to say that you got to look at it. You're going to the site visit. Your only job, what you're thinking in my mind, what I think, is I'm going there to be the exterminator. I'm going to kill deals. That's my job. It has to survive for me to go forward. Right? Because I'm going to be hard on it. I can't be nice to it. I got to be hard to the deal. I owe it to my investors. I got to sleep like a baby. I know this. Right? I don't ever forget these rules. And so that's the lens. The only lens I'm looking at it is my investor lens. It's the lens that you should all look at when you're looking at your cash flow calculator. Don't look at your lens or what you're trying to make. Just look at the investor lens. How do I sleep like a baby and make sure I get them paid? If you'll look at it from that perspective, you'll make better choices. Just, you have to do it, right? About 7 to 10. Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes less. It all depends on if it's the good referral, right? Then it's a lot less. Seventy-five, and really, I'm trying to be closer to 100. I want to be like 92, 95, right? 75 is really on the very bottom. It's got to be a smoking deal for me to do that. And just so the reason for that is 75 units will really afford two staff, right? A maintenance guy and a leasing person and a management company, but barely. And that's low end. So I'd much rather do 100. That gives me just enough juice to kind of, because I want to be able to pay well, because you get what you pay for when it comes to staffing, right? So we actually have, we pay higher than the normal because we get better people for that. And it's worth it. Yeah, go find brokers that do that. And I'll say if 20 or 50 is your comfort level, do direct mail marketing, right? Because that is a mom and pop side, right? You'll get more better off market, probably owner financing, right? I just don't teach it. I don't know how to do it because I don't do it. I know people that do. Tim Bratz is another guy that does that really well, right? And that's his model that he teaches. I teach the big shit, right? Because I want to be that lazy investor. Right? Yes. Thanks for the clap.
Yeah. what's the percent the brokers are usually getting on these deals?
So what do the brokers make to do these deals? On average, like, so on a bigger deal, like 2%. On a smaller deal, maybe 3, maybe 4. But if you're paying 4, you're probably paying too much. Right? So, like, I underwrite a 2% exit, and I'll be like, that's what I'm paying you if you want my listing. And they're like, okay. Right? So but that's why brokers don't split commissions. So I don't know if you guys notice it. Like, in the residential world, you have the buyer broker and seller broker. No.
So what's the percentages on this seller?
If you're going to bring a buyer broker that's representing you, you're paying that broker out of your own pocket. That broker ain't selling. He ain't giving up anything. He'd be like, good luck. Right? So that's what I've noticed, right? Like, that's usually how it works in the commercial game. Those brokers, they ain't like, you're on your own, bro. Good luck.
But when brokers are bringing you the deal, there's no little
handoff. Yeah, I'm asking, I deal with all the brokers and I get their listings, mm-hmm. right? So I'm only dealing with listing brokers. Okay. I'm going to get my list. That's why I said 5 to 7, because you want the listing brokers that are listing deals. Right? And I want to know all of them. So that's why I don't have a buyer broker. I'm like, dude, why would I use you as a buyer broker? I already got all the guys. They give me all their shit. They're calling me. So why do I need you to, why would I pay you extra? I know that sounds weird or mean, but like, it's the truth.
So you're
yeah, but they don't even, like, yeah, it is that, but like, commercial brokers, they don't even talk in real estate language. Like, they have a license, some of them, but I swear to God, every deal that we do is not, it could go to some kind of arbitration and I'd probably win, is because they don't give me any disclosures. None. Different game. Like, I know in Arizona, like, I've got, they're brokers, right? I mean, they really have to be brokers. And, like, we do and talk and trade and none of that stuff gets out. I don't sign anything. Never have. Never will. It's really weird. Yeah. But, and ask me if I've gotten out of deal because of that one time. I had a hard money deal. It was represented from a broker, and I had to complain to the Department of Real Estate, and I got my earnest money back because I knew the game. They're like, oh, I'm like, where did you didn't have me sign up by a broker. You know, you're like, were you representing me or representing them? I couldn't tell. You never disclosed. You know? Something feels wrong here, Department of Real Estate. I don't know. I just want my earnest money back. I feel like it was a bad, you know, breach of fiduciary. And I got my money back. And it sucked, but I was like, that's $50,000 I didn't want to lose. Right? And because it was, the deal turned bad and the seller was a prick. All right. So are we good here? So we good at the site visit part? Yeah? All right. Let's keep on going. All right. So if it beats the site visit and it's a hell yeah, right? This is when I start getting like the happy dance, right? Because this is like, oh, hold on. We're fixing to get, I think we got a chance, right? It passed. Now let's go write an LOI. Okay. A letter of intent. This is when we're going to send an offer to the broker saying, here's what we want to pay. Here's kind of our terms, and here's kind of our due diligence that we want and that we have, right? Now, in that LOI, there's a way to do it, and this is, if you guys come to my three-day thing, we teach this exactly, but I'll give you the cliff notes, is you're going to have your LOI, and it should be like a 2 to 3 pager. It should be really simple. It shouldn't be very complicated English, right? We save the complicated stuff for the attorneys when they do the PSA, the purchase and sale agreement, okay? But for that LOI, we want it very plain, common terms, right? And then, so it's the LOI, it's your credibility kit, it's your management credibility kit, and it's a proof of funds. And we could talk about proof of funds at my event and how you can create, like we all know that you can create anything, and proof of funds are only good as the 5 minutes that you print it off the printer, right? Proof of funds. You can get proof of funds from partners, investors. You can have plenty of people that can give you a proof of funds, right? So I would say, like, in the beginning, I would probably say I used proof of funds from other people, right? Now I just use my own proof of funds. But, like, in the beginning, I found partners that could give me a proof of funds, right? If they had an IRA account, send me that IRA account. You're going to be a partner in my deal, like, and put them in a partner in your deal. Like, that's what you need, right, to help proof up your deal. And brokers will, like, you know. Now, realtors are realtors. Can we all agree to that? Right? Realtors are realtors. And I don't mean this in any disrespect, because I know there's a lot of realtors in this. But I'm just saying, from the buyer's perspective, my goal is just to make sure that he can feel like I can give him the paycheck. And I want that broker to know, like, I'm your best chance at getting paid. That's what I want to do. So I give him a complete package. Because when I have, like, listen, I've already got my management team squared away. Here's who they are. I've already got my team. I've bought stuff. And, you know, then you're putting such a nice resume out there. So, because what does that broker really do? He's going to go to the seller, and he's going to sell you. And because you may not have the best offer, right? You may, but if you look like you're the guy that can close and bring it home, and you can convey that to the broker, it does have intrinsic value. It doesn't always work, but am I going to try to stack the deck as best I can? Man, I sure am. Right? So setting up that LOI, doing it correctly. And so there's a little thing too called pricing guidance. So here's how this works. You call the broker. So usually there's a call for offers, right? So meaning the broker says, I got a listing, call for offers. This is if it's not off market, it's on market. Call for offers. They're due on Friday at 5 p.m. At 4 p.m., Corey's making the call. John, call for offers. I need some pricing guidance, right? I don't need to be at the top. But I just need to know, is 13.5, is that going to get me in the best final? You know, am I hot or cold? And dude, they'll tell you. They won't tell you the number, but they'll get you close. You know, and sometimes it doesn't always work out. It's not an exact science. But again, we're just talking with the people element. And so you're going to say, hey, listen, and here's what I've learned. When you're telling the broker about this deal, you've got to convey and let him know, you're not thinking about it. You kind of like this deal. You're like, John, I want to win this deal. I say it with confidence, clarity. John, I want to be the guy that wins this deal. Right? I know you're going to go into best and final, right? I just want to make sure I'm invited to best and final. We're thinking about 13.5. Do you believe that gets us into the best and final round? Because we could probably pay more. Because I took my strike price and then I went down a little bit, right? And I probably took my earnest money and I went down a little bit. So I've got things I'm gonna do to my offer, but I'm constructing my LOI because I want to try to get into the best and final where there's maybe two or three of us at the end, right? And the trick is you never know what they're doing. Like if they got four or five buyers, maybe they only have one and they're stringing you along. You just don't know, but you got to play the game, right? And so I stack it. He says, okay, here's what you'd be in this. So then, yep, all of a sudden next week, Corey, you're invited to the best and final. Well, no kidding. Thank you. Right? So now in the best and final, they say best and final is due on the next Friday. Or, you know, in Tuesday at 5 p.m. Now, if I really want the deal, I'm going to really work hard at this. I'm calling again at 5 p.m. whenever it's due. I want everybody's offer to already be in. I want whoever the broker is to have every offer that's out there, and I'm going to make the call. And now, if I've done my job right, and John knows me, the broker knows me, we've had breakfast, we've talked, he likes me, I like him, we talk cars or golfing or all the stuff that we've been talking about. I've cultivated this relationship. You see where I'm going here? Is he going to give me the number? He's going to give me the number pretty damn close. Especially if he thinks that I can give him his paycheck. And so I'll ask, I'm like, dude, and so the word though is called pricing guidance. Write down pricing guidance. That's what you're going to ask a broker for. John, I need some pricing guidance. I really want this deal. I'll say it 10 times. John, I'm the buyer on this property. I want to own it. I want to be the guy that owns it. Because I want them to hear it so many times that with my conviction, I want to own this deal, John. Help me get this deal. I think I'm the right buying group. I think we have the right plan for it. I know we've seen it. We understand what we can take it to. It's the right deal for us. We've already got our loan set up. We've got our financing squared away, John. I'm the right guy. I need some pricing guidance. I want to win. I want to win. Does this get me there? Does this get me there? You know, and shut up. And let him square him, and he might just tell you the number. And it happens a lot. They'll tell you. They will. They don't always want to, but you can play it, right? And you just got to judge it. And sometimes they're not always comfortable on giving you the number. Some guys will just say, Corey, make it 13.5 and it's yours. Right? They'll say it just like that. You got to come in 13.5, I'll get it sold. I'll get it done. Right? Especially if it's off-market deal. Like I'm negotiating price, he's like, dude, come in at 3.2 and I'll make it, or you know, like I'll go sell it. I'll make it happen. So that's like some of the times you get frankness. But sometimes you get the other guy, you know, like it is ethics, right? So I get it. But I'm gonna push it because I'm trying to get a deal, I'm trying to win a deal, and I'm trying to have an unfair advantage. Cause that's my job as the buyer. I'm trying to stack, I want a deal. So, but I just got you there, and there's a nice little line there. But sometimes they'll just be like, listen, and if they're really resistant, then we'll just play hot or cold. Am I hot or am I really cold with this offer? And because then they're not disclosing the price. Everybody wins on hot and cold. You know, is 13.5 hot? Whoa, it's hot. You know, thank you, John. That's all I needed to know, right? Thank you, you know. And then, so hot and cold works a lot as well. And I find, like, that's, some brokers will just tell you the number. Other people want to play hot or cold. And some of them, some guys will just not tell you at all, right? There's the one guy that I bought a deal from. He was just not going to tell me. And I was like, that's the guy. And I actually bought it from him. And I was like, when I sell, I'm going to use him. Right? It's always different when you're the seller, right? Listen, I'm just giving it to you real world, okay? I can sugarcoat it and tell you all the other things, but I'm just telling you how deals really get done. And so it's good and bad and somewhere in between. But, you know, it's a living, breathing thing. And, you know, if I can help you, you know, champion it to stack the deck a little bit and get a little bit better, you know, like, you know, the odds are forever in your favor kind of thing, then let's do it, right? Okay, so over here, LOI, they say, finally, and this is when I get happy, they say, Corey, we're awarding you the deal, you've won. And like, that's a great feeling. That's just the start, right? But it's like, dude, I got a deal. Right? Now, but sometimes, again, remember, LOI, we could have negotiated, and they came up with a price that I had to go back to my cash flow calculator, update the numbers, make sure it's worked, because it could be a no. Get to the purchase and sell agreement. Even though we've agreed on stuff, sellers come back and sometimes say, well, I know that wasn't in there, but I want to throw this thing in there. Or what I always try to do, it's never in my LOI, I always ask for a 30-day extension, and I always get it. But it's never in my LOI. Why? Because I know they're going to strike it down in the LOI. And I don't even want to play the game, so I just don't even put it there. And then I have my attorney, who is an absolute ninja, puts it in there and always gets it. And we always try to get it a 30-day extension for free, and 50% of the time he gets it. And then the other 50% we have to pay for it. Like, you know, you pay another $50,000 earnest money to get an extra 30 days. And why do you get an extension? Because, guys, you never know what's going to happen in real estate. And as a syndicator, the more time you have to raise capital, the better. So I try to stretch my deals as humanly long as possible. So here's how I do it, and write this down. In my purchase and sell agreement, I will put 30 business days. Not calendar days, but business days. But it says 30, and it's in brackets. It looks like 30, right? But the business days means 45 calendar days, okay, on my DD, on my due diligence period. Even if they say there's no DD period, right, because sometimes they want it hard on day one, I still have a 45-day due diligence period, or 30 business days. And it's always just 30 business days. Then I want another 30 business days for COE, close of escrow, right, in my LOI. That's another 45 days, right? And then I always put in there my 30, and we try to do business days here, but a lot of times we'll accept calendar days, 30 calendar days extension, okay? So if you total that all up, it's 120 days. 45 plus 45 plus 30 is 120 days. That's a pretty long wick to start a deal and close a deal, right? And I think, and we've been able to get it almost in every property that we've ever bought today, right? So, and we do use those extensions sometimes, right? There's times where you just have to, like, one of my deals, I'm doing selling the Palms to buy Carolina Creek that we just showed, but Palms got pushed back 3 weeks. Because it's a tenth, or it's a assumption, and the assumption is taking forever, and so they had to get an extension. So then I had to use my extension. So, you know, that's why you have it. You just don't know if you got to put an oh crap, I didn't expect that. It gives you more time. Huh? We're gonna close. We're buying the property.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah, purchase date. Today you gotta wire all the money.
Do you also give the extension as a seller? Like, I was into a deal, and for me, the seller gave me a 14 days, calendar days, for due diligence. I just walked out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I, they'll always try to counter me on that negotiations. And I was like, I'm usually pretty strong on that part. I'm like, guys, listen, I don't know how you buy properties. But I have a really good record of buying properties and actually transacting. I don't fall out of stuff, but like, I do a very good job up front of determining all the things that I got to do on a property. So then I have no like aha moments on the back. And so this is what it takes for me to like, I know there's companies that can do it. That's just not me. Like, so if you want other guys, go do it. I just really try to push back and say, guys, this is my timeline. I'll also say, and I don't try to say this because this is usually not a good thing to say that you're a syndicator, but I've done enough deals now and I just like, listen, that's what I do. You know, I syndicate properties. I'm very good at it. I've got a very good track record of raising capital. It takes a little time to get all these things put together, to get the legal stuff done and to look at the properties, and it's just the timeline that it takes. And a lot of times they'll understand once you paint it right and you don't try to you just be very honest with them, that works really well. But the other part is it does take time to do a real good due diligence. So I didn't show this to you guys, but like if you look at my construction Excel sheet, I mean we go through every unit. So they have to physically take pictures of every unit, right? We go back into a software, construction management software, to assign values of everything that we're going to do. And then we track that thing for the whole project per unit. So we can know, here's what we budgeted, here's what we spent, you know, and here's the outcome. Where's the delta, right? And so it's very important. Yeah, go ahead. 100,000. Great question, by the way. I'll say that when I first started, I said 50. Mistake. Right? Ask for hundreds, get hundreds. Ask for 50s, get 50s. Right? And once you start really learning the velocity of money, you need to ask for hundreds. And then say, do you want to put more? Right? Because it starts with 100. Most people, the right investor too, is that $100,000 investor. The, you know, 50,000, not so much. Right? Because you can get squeaky wheels like just that'll waste your time. But not, you know, I got to say, I mean, I have. Pardon me? No, we do 506B offerings. So they're accredited and uncredited. We can have up to, I think, is it 32? Or I can't remember the number. Unaccredited investors. Most of our investors are accredited. But the reason I like the 506B is I don't have to proof them up. Right? If they just check the box, that works on a 506B. So I just got to have a personal relationship or have a process to bring in to where I have a financial relationship, a fiduciary, pre-existing fiduciary relationship with them, right? And then I'm good. So we have a process built into our funnel. And if you guys ever want to see that, go to kahunainvestments.com and click Get in the Deal Room, right? And, huh? Get in the Deal Room. Yeah, you'll go through my, you'll be getting stuff to become one of my investors. And you'll see the process. We'll do a Zoom call, right? Actually, you'll do it with my wife. She handles that. She only gives me, after you meet her prereq, then you get to go see me. But we have an onboarding process of how we take people from online to relationship-based, asking them financial questions, to having them fill out an accredited investor questionnaire. So we have very much documented process so we can, if I ever get audited by the SEC, which I have been twice and come out clean every time, but dude, there's nothing like giving 10 years of your financials and like grabbing your ankles. It's an unpleasant experience. Okay? And it's a $15,000 experience with your attorney to do it with you. And it's happened to me twice, both times fine. And they're like, you're one of the good guys. Thanks. Thanks. One of the good guys, $15,000 later, you know. And the first one is I did an event called How to Become the High Benefit Reward of Being the Bank. I was not even doing single or multifamilies. I was doing single family, and I was just teaching how they could fund and be the bank and get a first position, right? So there's only one investor with one deal, and it was not – there was no – SEC anything. But and they did a whole, like, at the end, the last thing, they're like, do you remember this girl that called? And I actually remember, because it was really weird, said she had dad's money. I was like, well, like, and I was trying to make an appointment. I was like, if you can't meet me, we can't talk. I can't do a deal with you. So like, I tried and followed up 3 or 4 times, and I was like, all right, well, you know, that is what it is. And then, so at the end, they showed me and revealed, like, remember what she said? Because I send her, like, all my documentation on how we do it, our process. And it was, I come out smelling like a rose, right? It's great. It's at the end. But they sure grilled me. It's like, you know, and you're just sitting there like, I'm trying to make sure, you know, you're like worried, did I do everything on every deal correctly? Because they look at it with a fine tooth comb. And we did. And so, but was it a fun experience? No. Right? So I'm just telling you that thing is real and I respect it. Twice being through it. We do not cheat. We follow the rules, man. You just got to follow the rules, right? So you don't advertise. You have pre-existing relationships. You documentate it up all the way through, and that's how you do good deals, right? Great question, by the way. Okay, so purchase and sales contract, yes, right? We get that. We finally get the deal. Now, by the way, there's a red dot right there, and that's because you're going to have to come up with some of that earnest money. And nowadays, it's hard, right? So in between these two things right here, so this is kind of the new thing right now. It's called early access, right? So you can have, like, in between getting a deal under contract, or they accepted your LOI, but now you've going to usually it takes about 3 to 4 weeks for attorneys to get together to, like, bang out a purchase and sell agreement. Because, like, we write the first draft, then we send it to the seller. The seller redlines it and marks it all up, and, like, it goes back and forth. It's like attorney time, right? And they love it. I hate it. But I got a great attorney and he loves it. Like, he's like, he calls it his Picasso, right? So that's the guy I want to work with. Like, he loves writing those things and reading every little detail. Not me. But nowadays, because they want you to go hard on day one, you've got to be, like, how do you put $400,000 hard on a property if you've not even looked at it? Like, riddle me that question. Like, it's the weirdest thing. And how the people in our industry have made this happen is the dumbest thing ever, in my opinion. I hate this part of it. So the early access is where now you have them sign early access agreements. It's kind of like a mini PSA to get you access into the property so you can go in there and then do a full due diligence. Like, you're going to do that before you even contract it. But you have to, because that's the only time you have power. Because you can come back before you finish up that contract and then renegotiate if you have to. Right? So that's where you're going to renegotiate now, is right up front before you even have it under contract. And so the early access will get you into their financials and stuff, but they don't always give you everything. It's really weird. But so you've got to have some language in your early access agreement that gets you at least, you know, real T-12s, real numbers, real financials, and at least a good look. Because you're asking to get into some of their sensitive documents, which they may or may not want to be a part of. It's like, we don't have an agreement. Well, but you want me to sign something without me. It's like a yin and yang. Well, but you want me to buy it and put $400,000 hard. And, you know, like, there's got to be a little bit of give. And so that's kind of the new standard that I'm seeing is early access agreements.
But they just accepted your LOI.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. So they've accepted my LOI. They're saying, Corey, we want to give you the deal. And then I'm like, well, and now in my LOI I have early access language that I'm going to get early access, and they need to provide it, and here's what I want in that early access, which is the same list of all my other stuff that I would normally do in my DD. But I still don't waive my DD, because I'm just like, all I'm going to be able to do is really, because I don't have enough time in the 5, 10 days, 14 days to do a real thorough DD. I'm just going to be able to go in every unit and see what I see. Right? But I've not then tallied it up and said, here's how much it costs. So you're going there with a team to make sure that you're not going to make a bad mistake. Right? That's usually your management company and your construction manager. You're going to go in there and make sure, like, do we see any, you know, dead bodies, Waldos, that's going to really hinder us from going forward? Is there any deal killers in this DD that says we should run? And so I'll give you an example of what that looks like. I had one property. We were under contract for a long period of time, and when the numbers worked, it was good. We did a site visit. Now we're just under normal contract, not hard money, but just a normal. So we get there, and dude, there's like the manager's a dog lover, but not just like a dog lover, but like a big dog lover. She loves big dogs. And dude, we're going into units, and everybody's got a big ass dog. And then you start looking, walking the property like big-ass turds, right? Everywhere. I was like, oh, my God. And, dude, the amount of damage from these pets was... And, dude, then we found pigs. This was in Mississippi. We found swine. A couple of oinkers. And you're just like, are you kidding me? You got pet pigs in here, dude. I mean, dude... And so we realized at that point, like, that our numbers were not going to work, right? Because, like, our rehab numbers, what we budgeted for and what we, like, was going to be totally drastic. So we had to walk away. So that's what happened on that.
That was their emotional service animal.
Yeah. So, but, like, that was a real deal. And now, walking away at due diligence, now I've already put down $25,000 to loan application, right? I spent $10,000 on the DD to get there to have the team come in and go through every door. I'm in it for $35,000 plus a little plus my PSA from my attorney. I'm in it $40,000 almost, I feel like. And I got to walk away. Right? Let that sink in for a minute, because this is the game we're playing. Okay? I'm not there to scare you off, but I'm really like, but I would do you a disservice if I didn't give you the reality and the risk involved. Right? And now, good deals solve all these things, right? Because you can have one bad deal, and that deal we walked away. I'm proud to say that we walked away. And it was right, is the right thing to do. We walked away. Yeah, we lost $50,000. We'll make it up on the next deal. You gotta have partners in your deals that you can, or you have to be, have the wherewithal to weather that. If you don't, find a partner that does. Like, they can see the big picture, and then on the next deal, you just make sure that they get that money back first. Right? So there's a way to solve these things. When it comes to a rotten apple like that, that we would have never sold that. But once we got there and we started going, because it was big dog, big dog, big dog, we're like, whoa. And it was like, that's sure not what they showed us when they showed us the nice units when we did the site visit, right? They just showed us, it was like, there's nothing to see here, right? So it's crazy. Huh? Yeah. All right, so we make it through the purchase and sell agreement, right? We do our due diligence. Again, now, normally in a normal market, this is the opportunity that you get to negotiate. But now, most of the time, it's right here. It's in that due diligence, in that early access agreement. That's your only time that you're going to have a little bit of negotiating power. Because they've already gave you the deal. They awarded it to you. They don't want to have to go back to market. That takes time. And so that's your opportunity to ask. Okay? So that's where you want to gather as much information to use it against them. I'm like, everybody comes in with a gun, but they're not loaded. You got to get the ammo, right? The ammo is in all the pictures and stuff. And to show them, hey, this is why I need $150,000 or $200,000 price reduction. Because you didn't tell me about all this stuff. Right? But in a normal contract, it's right here. It's actually right at the end of due diligence. And it's really there. The hard money line. Right? In between due diligence and close is the hard money, where your money's going to go hard. That line now is way up here most of the time. But occasionally you can get it to get in your contract just like a normal contract. Right? And we use this all the time. I've almost on every deal, I've been able to negotiate something better. Like, I didn't see this. We didn't see that. We need $150,000, $125,000. I've always been able to find a little. I don't know why, because I just feel like it's fun. But I'd retrade a little bit. Not always, but I don't mind retrading if I see it and it's very vagrant. Right? If it's very in your eyes, I'm going to ask for it. But again, and then you might have to negotiate, and then if you do, and you have to change your numbers, you got to go back to your calculator and make sure it still works. Everything has to go back to your calculator and make sure your numbers are still working when you make big changes and things change financially when your numbers, okay? But once you get past this hard money line close, now you've got that extra 30 business days and you got to close, right? Does that make sense? Crazy, right? It's a crazy world. Like, when you look at it from that, you're like, gosh damn, do I even want to do this thing? Right? It scared the hell out of me, right? It is a bigger boy game, right? Bigger boy, bigger girl game. But you can do it with the right partners that it doesn't have to be as crazy or as risky, right? And you just got to understand what you're doing. And that's part of what you guys here, at least, I'm trying to give you as big a glimpse as I can into the thing that I do. Does that make sense? And I'm just telling you, if I can figure it out, I promise all you guys can, because you're way smarter, definitely way more prettier. Okay? And so it is a very doable deal, and you just got to find your right team to do it. And when you get there, you can always say, you can always change your team like we've talked about, right? Do deals, not partnerships, and it makes sense. All right. So I got to go from the, now I'm just going to tell you what everything costs, right? So we just went through the process. Now I'm going to tell you like where you're going to spend money and how it's going to happen, right? I'll go through this a little faster, but like, You know, site visits, you got flights, hotels, time, that's $1,500 easily, right? Every time you got to do a site visit, that's where you're going to spend money, right? You know, if you go in there, so from site visit to LOI, right? Here's what, I get an LOI, like, they've maybe not said yes, or they're close to saying yes. Here's who I'm going to contact. I'm going to engage my contract lawyer. Sometimes my lawyer might make the LOI for me. Not really, right? Because I got a real basic LOI. So I usually do the LOI myself. But I'm also going to, I have a title company that I'm working with. And I have three phases kind of that I work with, like, with my contract lawyer. We kind of have the first part in the middle and the end, right? So things kind of go somewhere in the middle. I've pre-negotiated some pricing for what it takes to do a closing. Now, at the end of the day, he still charges me per hour, but we have a pretty good idea. He'll let me know if we're starting to get kind of crazy, right? Because sometimes you get New York legal on the seller side, and it's like they want every I and T crossed, and it's lots of little things, lots of communication, and your legal bill goes up. So it's almost $25,000 per phase, right? So when you get your LOI, done, now I'm going to alert my lender, right? John, we got a deal, right? We're getting ready. And I've probably already talked to my lender at this point because I've already done, like, when I'm doing a site visit, I'm like, hey, listen, I got the site visit. I need to know what are my lending criteria in this area. Is it 80% LTV? Is it 75% LTV? I want to know, like, what's the marketplace looking like? What's my rate in this marketplace? Because every market's a little different, right? Is it a review market in Freddie or Fannie? And he'll give me kind of the lay of the land, and it's because he's going to work on getting me some options. So I want to have that conversation a little bit early, probably on the site visit. But when I get an LOI, I'm letting him know we're in play. I'm getting ready to get this deal, like, start doing it for real now. I need what's called term sheets, right? The lender's going to go get me term sheets of real, not just what the market is, but he's going to get a lender to say, here's what we'll lend and here's the rules. Okay? That's term sheets. My lawyer, he's going to write the LOI. So I'll send him the LOI and say, this is what we got. Write my purchase and sales contract. He's like, great, no problem. And then I'm also letting my management company know, hey, we got one, that one that we went and looked at, that they're part of that conversation. I think I got one coming on the line. Get ready, right? Even though it's still going to be a long time, it's going to be 120 days, I just want everybody to know what we're doing because you want to keep them in the loop. So that, between LOI and purchase and sales contract, 2 to 3 weeks, sometimes four. Sometimes when I'm trying to put Voltron together, because this is actually where, from here to here, is where I'm usually going to put together my general partnership, right? I already got some people that I'm thinking about, like, okay, I got Michael. Michael said he's got, you know, $2 million of capital. I'll put you in my deal. You're going to give me some of the earnest money, $300,000. Got you. You're going to get 5%. You're getting 20%. Maybe I'll fund the rest of it myself. Maybe I want another partner. And I'm kind of looking at who I'm going to put my deal together, right? That's what you'll usually do. That's what I'm doing in this phase and getting it all kind of concrete and like in. Like, get us all in agreement to what we're going to do, okay? And sometimes when I don't have it all put together, I'll tell my attorney, my lawyer, doing the contract, I'll be like, hey, Wayne, slow play this one for me. Right? Wayne knows what that means. Okay, Corey. And Wayne caves to, you know, a couple extra days before he replies. You know, because it's lawyer time, right? So he can extend me out another week if I really had to just by, you know, I'm a lawyer, I'm busy. You know? So it is what it is. As long as we see movement, you know, but you can string it out easily another week if you had to, if you need to kind of get everything together. So that's kind of like, that's my time to put what I think is my deal together with all the players that I'm going to put in my deal. That's what you guys have, right? That's your little window. And in the beginning, you should be doing this already. You should be thinking this right now as you're thinking about putting, you know, deals together. Start developing potential partners. And you'll see how the pieces put together, right? Make a list of who you think could be someone that could help you get a deal together. Then you go to your purchase and sales contract, right? This is when you're going to deposit your earnest money. I'm then calling my PPM lawyer. Now, I've actually just changed this now. Wayne is my contract lawyer, but he's also got a big firm. He's like, Corey, I'll handle it all for you. I'm like, I like that option. So now I've just got one lawyer that does it all. But I used to have, like, you guys know Mauricio? Mauricio Raul. So in our space, Mauricio is a SEC attorney for creating your private placements, a PPM, private placement memorandum. He'll put that together. It's usually about $15,000 to put together a PPM to protect you and do it the right and legal way. So you're spending some money there. You're creating your LLC. So once I get a purchase and sales contract ready to ink and sign, I'm already now starting to get my LLCs created for that entity structure. I create a buying entity LLC, and I create what's called a founders LLC. I call it, like, if it's Sea Creek Apartments, then I'll have Sea Creek Founders LLC. And that's just where I keep my GP. So we buy the property with the Sea Creek Apartments, and it has A shares and B shares, and B shares are owned by Sea Creek Founders. And then the Founders LLC is where I'm going to put my LLC, your LLC, your LLC, all my partnership group will collectively be in that group together. Does that make sense? All right, cool. So this is good stuff. I'm trying to give you as much as I can. Right? Okay. I'm firming up. I'm looking for now loan quotes. When we get to the PSA, I'm like, you know, Aaron with Bricadia, I'm like, Aaron, I'm looking. I want to get quotes. I want to get term sheets. I'm also talking to my insurance, right? So I'm like, dude, once we sign that PSA, we need to have, like, insurance starting to work. I need to get really firmed up, make sure I got the right quotes that doesn't change. Now, this has happened where they gave me something in the beginning and then shit changed in the end. I'm like, whoa, what happened? Sometimes you can use that. You can negotiate that. Sometimes you can't. Sometimes you have to eat it. Right? Because insurance is crazy right now across the country. Make sure that you get the right insurance coverage. I have a property in New Orleans in Slidell, and it just got hammered by Ida. Don't feel bad. It's a good thing. No one was hurt. No one was hurt. But I'm going to get a new property. I'm telling you, I'm getting new. I mean, it's bad right now, but I'm going to have a claim where I'm going to get, and I've owned it for 5 years. Every year I've watched hurricanes go by. I'm like, oh, we missed. Here at the end, I'm ready to sell it, right? And it gets hit, and I was like, I told him like a couple of days before, I was like, man, I'm praying that no one gets hurt, but like, can you just hit my property a little bit, please? Right? Because I need a new roof. I need some things, and I'm getting, like, the remediation. It'll be a $7 million claim. I bought this property for $3.6 million, but it's going to be a $7 million claim at the end of the day. Just because, like, with remediation, how it works, because there's mold and stuff from the roof damage, they can't just, like, take out the walls. They got to take out everything. All the cabinets, I mean, everything. So it's gutted to the studs. Brand new LVP flooring. I mean, oh my God. Half of the units have been hit. Half. I have income replacement. So I've got a full building even though it's vacant. Okay? Don't feel bad for me. But properly insured. Now, that insurance every year cost me $118,000 to insure that property in New Orleans. But, you know, it's going to pay off, but it is tough, right? He's going through it, like, because, you know, we had to come up with a lot of extra money recently just to fund it till the insurance money kicks in. So, like, I'm feeding that property hundreds of thousands of dollars right now as we kind of get through it. But it'll all come out in the end, so that's okay. But again, insurance quotes. Now, here's a real key, and you can't really see it very well. Every deal that I do, I open 5 bank accounts. Everybody put up their hand. Give me 5. 5 bank accounts. Okay? Now you're going to thank me for this one, or you better write them down. First account is operations account. Second account, capital improvement account. Third account, security deposit account. Fourth account, self-escrow account. And the fifth account is your, hold on, I lost my track. Hold on, what's the last one? Security deposit, self-escrow. I said operations. What do you got there? Account improvement, deposit, self-escrow, operations. The mystery account. It'll come to me. So I didn't even put it on the slide deck. I opened up five accounts. I can't remember what the last one's for. But the reason for it is, here's what happens. Yeah. Operations, site visit. Hold on, let me just look at it one more time. I'm getting on the spot, so I'm like, operations, capital improvement. The real important one. Owner distribution account. Okay, that one. Super important. Now, there's reason, this is kind of a Dave Ramsey thing in a way, but my management companies don't always like it, but I don't give two craps. Because I know this is a fact. Whatever is in your operations account can and will get spent. Right? You have to sweep money every month into the right things every month. Right? So when I do a deal and I know that I've got I have my investor payment of, $30,000 every quarter. So I'm going to take $10,000 every month and I'm sweeping it over into my owner distribution account every month like clockwork on the 10th. Right? I want that money to get out of my operations account. I want it to be held in a nice, safe place that we do not cut checks from. Right? Same thing with any self-escrows. Like, let's say the insurance company or the bank doesn't do my insurance or taxes. Well, I better damn well be putting money every month and it doesn't get touched. Right? Because when the taxes are due, you got to pay them. Insurance, got to pay it. And so, if you keep that money in the operations, it may or may not be there. Right? So it's just better to just set it up and sweep it. Sweep it. Security deposits, also, obviously, security deposits for your tenants, keep that separate. And then your capital improvement money, you don't want that in ops either, right? Because, this operations will figure out a way to use all your money. I don't know why that is, but that's just the rule that I've seen, and it's true that I know of. So that way, when you do capital improvement projects and you have a construction management company, they can submit all their invoices, then my management company will then take the money from capital improvements, move it into operations, and then pay the bills. Right? So it's a good way just kind of keep you on track. I had to learn that one the hard way. But I'm glad that I learned it, right? Because when I first started, I didn't do it like that. It was a shit show. And then, when your taxes are due, you're like, oh my God, what in the hell are we, how are we figuring it? Like, why are you telling me this now? Like, and so I learned. Pardon me? Taxes and insurance and owner distribution. Yep. Okay. That's a good one, by the way, guys. That's something you don't see in a normal little presentation. Like, that's some little weed stuff right there, like in the details, minutia. But that's money. That five accounts, money. Yeah, if you're running properties, yeah. I would. Like, yeah, I would, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I don't know why, I thought about that. I was like, I should teach people. I know people are like, when they're getting ready to buy their money, like, how many accounts am I supposed to open? Like, five. Just put it up to five. You don't know why, but just open up five and then you'll start to see why. Okay, so again, due diligence, about 30 business days. We've talked about that. Keyword being business days. In that due diligence period, I don't know what that happened, but, in your due diligence, you're usually going to spend between $10,000, maybe a little bit more if it's a big property, for due diligence, right? Now, a lot of management companies will charge you, but if you use them, sometimes they'll credit you back or they'll credit you half, right? But if you don't close, you're going to be out the full money. So you got to budget for the full amount that it takes, and then maybe get charged half, right? So sometimes it's around eight. I think it's on average $8,000 to $10,000 for a due diligence. That's where they go through every property, and they're helping you and doing a financial audit as well. Like the financial audit is just as important as the physical audit of the property. Okay. Wow, it's going fast, isn't it? Jeez Louise. I feel like I'm talking way too slow, but hopefully we're getting good stuff. Pardon me? Yeah, I make them set up automatic sweeps. So for the deposits, secure deposits, they do that on their own. But like for my, a lot of times, so, and here's the one other big caveat. You own your accounts. Do not let a management company open up accounts for you. You open them up yourself, and you own them. You add them on there, but you own the accounts. Don't ever do it. Let them set it up. You want to have control. You want to have your own access. You give them online access. Own your accounts. Okay? Why? Because you know why. You always want to have control. You just always don't do it because it makes it easy. Do it because you do the work up front, get all your accounts. It's a pain in the ass to get them added, but it's you want to own your accounts. Right? So
I wondered if you trust them to separate.
I do. 100%, right? But
you've built that relationship.
But I'm always going to verify. Was it President Reagan's to trust but verify? Right? So, so here's how we do it. So, we have a CPA, I'll get you in a minute. We have a CPA company, my management company has their own CPAs in-house doing books. And they're very clean books. Like, they give me the bank account and the reconciliation of that account every month. Right? I actually forward that to my investors, too. I think it's very smart to give your investors full blown books, all of it. Very highly important. Be an open book with your records. Do not hide. Do not shy away. It is the best thing you can do. It'll build you a great integrity and great track record, right? Then we have a CPA. I have my CPA firm that every quarter they do quarterly checkups, and then if there's any journal entries or even if my management company, because they're CPAs, they can do a journal entry from my management company. But I usually want them to go over that with my CPA, so he keeps his own kind of set of, and we do quarterly checkups. So if there's any discrepancies on things don't tie up exactly, and a journal entry needs to be made, it comes from my CPA, right? And so like that's cooking the books. Like that's how CPAs can change things, you know. Journal entries. Journal entries are, you know, highly, you just want to make sure that, you know, you open books correctly, journal entries for the right amounts. And so it's just, I don't like it when my management company does journal entries. I want them to become from my CPA. I allow them to do it, but I just want to know. We want everybody in the know. Because that's a good way to make things go bye-bye. It normally goes to your management company. They'll charge you a fee when you close. They sometimes they'll want a little bit of money up front. Every management company is a little bit different, but they'll usually charge you once they have control and they have control of the accounts. They'll make sure they get themselves paid. Okay. Okay, Annie, you had a question. Yeah, so you can go into like Bank of America, like your CPA or your accounting team, if you give them online access correctly, they should be able to go in and say, make a recurring bank-to-bank transfer or account-to-account transfer for that amount of every month. And so that's how we do it. We just do it through ACH, yeah.
So the management and the CPA, they work together?
Yeah, well, so I have my third-party CPA, right, quarterly checks, right? And but they're in communication. If there's anything that's weird that they want to run by, they'll run it through my CPA. But they have their own CPA firm. And the reason, because they have their own true CPAs, they're certified public accountants. They have a code and a fiduciary that they have to abide. I feel real confident. If they were just accountants and just doing accounting but not CPAs, I would be really suspect. I would want every journal entry to come from my CPA. Does that make sense? I'd want my CPA to give them the journal entries to open up my books. Okay? Great questions, by the way. Good. This is great. All right. So, and then finally, we get the hard money line and we close. And so, this is all earnest money is at risk, right? And I told you guys about my extension that I have built in that can always give you an extra 30 days, right? So that's kind of, the breakdown of that whole process. I know we went through it twice, but it's kind of a little bit different mix on the second time of what will happen and why. Good stuff? All right. I feel like we should take a break. All right, let's take a break. So we're going to go into assembling Voltron. Oh, you want me to go back? I'm sorry. Yeah. All right, we're almost there. We're on the home stretch, guys. 4. It's an hour and 15.
With Triad Capital Investments, when you brought up the hard money thing, I'm a private lender.
Yeah.
So is that where I fit? Do you actually go after hard money lenders?
No. No, this is for me. This is.
Before I saw.
Yeah, there you go. All right, let's get back together. We're going to come up. Sorry about that. We ran a little long. Just want to make sure that we're all here. Thank you, guys. Thank you.
Before you go about the mastermind
class. Okay, we'll. Everybody say hallelujah because it's the last hour, power hour. I'm ready to rock. All right. Man, what a wonderful day. I mean, is it not a beautiful day, guys? I love this thing called real estate. I really love it. I get jazzed. I'm so glad of all the conversations that I've had up front. I'm about ready to lose my voice, but I'm going to keep going. But I love it. I love it so. And I think that I see what it does for people that get involved. And it does change lives. That I know. It's really changed my life, right? Okay, so here we go. Now we're going to go into a little bit of management, and we're going to do into, like, what is it, like, how to put those deals together, and what I see is a very common structure, okay? Now, I already know I'm going to have to go fast because now I'm getting closer. I've been telling too many stories, okay? So I got to go a little faster. Voltron, okay? So here's how we're going to make a deal. So this is, I'm just going to go over what I think a typical percentage, and by no means do not take this to heart. This is just how Corey sees it in his eyes, okay? Now, you can always negotiate to get anything that you want in life. That's your job, right? But I'm just telling you, if you were to come to me and say, I got a deal, I'm going to say a deal is worth 10% of my GP, okay? Right? And so, but I've seen other people squeeze people for this. I think a deal is pretty valuable. It's hard to find right now, so 10%. And like I'm saying, that's you do that and you do nothing else. You just bring a deal and you say, here you go, and I help you get it under contract. We get it under contract, and it actually goes into my name, and, like, you're going to get 10% of the GP, right? That's, I think, or, like, if you brought a deal to somebody, and that's a good way to kind of look at it, right? And that person's responsibility is equity get the deal, this is a sponsor. Hold on. I didn't even look. I thought it was some funny deal, but it's the same number. So sponsor. What does a sponsor get? Like if someone, a sponsor, and I'll say that I've cut this one in half. So sometimes the sponsor, for me, I'll give them 5% of my GP plus what they're going to get in their money, like whatever the money's paying. And use equity, get the deal, put up earnest money. And sometimes it depends if I need to sign for a loan, but I don't normally need my sponsors to prove up financials. I just want them to give me the earnest money. So it's worth 5% for me, but 10% if they're going to give you full financials and they're what's called bankable, or they have net worth. Because you'll need net worth almost to what you're going to buy. So if you're going to buy a $20 million deal, you're going to want to have like, you know, $15 or $20 million in net worth. Okay? Now, that takes a little time to get there, but so a lot of times it's easiest to get in a deal with a partner, right? A guy that's doing it. And guess what? Corey has his hand up. Okay? But I don't partner with people that don't go to my boot camp because I got to teach you the way, right? So you don't waste my time. Just being honest, right? That's my filter. That's why I created this whole thing, was to have bird dogs, right? To find, get people in the game and let's go play it, right? But by all means, a lot of times you can Voltron yourselves, right? You got to find it. And like, there's some smart people. There's money in this room. Like, people that know money, people that have contacts. All that stuff works. So that's what you do. So that's what I think that sponsor deal is, 10% of the deal. Use the equity, they put up their earnest money. Find a deal, right? So find a deal is worth, in my mind, it's worth 10%, right? 10%. Have a deal that pencils. Not hard, but like have one that financially makes sense, that works, right? That is deal. Now, here's my big one, right? Here's the big one. Capital. Find the money, right? Well, that's worth 40% in my mind, right? Now, I want you also to hear what I'm saying here, okay? This is as if you guys are the puppet masters, okay? So this is the structure that I use when I find my deal. I've got a deal, and if I needed other people to be in it, right? Or if someone brought me a deal, I'm like, I'm going to take 10%. Now, I might give that guy, say, listen, I'll take your deal, I'll finish it. You're going to get 10% GP. Now it's my deal, but now I'm going to go out and I'll give 40% of my deal away to the capital raise. Right? My goal personally, when I do deals, is to at least get a 50% ownership of my GP. Really, 51%. Okay? And we know all what that 1% means, right? Everything, right? Control. Okay? So I usually want 51% ownership of my GP. Or I'm going to make sure that everybody signs some paperwork when we do it, that we're going to elect another management company called Kahuna Management to be the manager, and that we have to have unanimous decision to change it, which means that I would have to vote to unlock myself, which I would never do. Thank you.
A really dumb question. What is GP?
General Partnership.
Okay, thank you. That's what I thought, but I wasn't sure.
Yep. Sorry. When I say acronyms, you got to let me know. Sometimes I. Pardon me? We do. Yep. So in other words, we create the operating agreement in our LLC for that founder's share, and in that we'll have our first meeting and amendment. That we're going, and I'll make them sign it to when we start, that they're going to elect Kahuna Management, which is my company, that I'm the only person in that, as the manager. So now I have control of operating the property. I don't have to worry about what ownership I have at that point in time. And I just make it, there's a unanimous vote has to occur to change that management company. So now I've put myself on the island and no one can kick me off. Does that make sense? Right? So that's just legal structuring, yeah. Correct. Yep.
Okay.
Yep. Write all my operating agreements up. Yep. So so I'm kind of giving this to you as like if I was to do a deal with you guys or you should look at it as if I get a deal. Here's how I look at my structure. Like, be willing to give up 40% of your deal to raising capital. Be willing to give up 10%. So if you go 40, 10, and 10, that's 60%. And you still carve out 40% for yourself. Well, that's not bad. Right? If you can find all the pieces. So that's the benefit of you locking up contract. Then you have control and you can be the puppet master and put it together, organize it. Right? And you can get paid doing that. That's what I do. That's what I've done, right? Well, yeah, so I say 51. I'm throwing a couple layers here. So I usually want to try to get 51% of my GP. Okay? But what I'm saying is if I don't, if I'm not going to get it, then I'm going to make sure that, well, I'm doing it every time. I'm going to create where we, our first group as a group, as a LLC, we're going to make an amendment, or not amendment, but we're going to vote to elect Kahuna and management as the manager. Right? So that just, all that does is just allow me to have control. So then I'm not so worried about it. I'm just trying to say, like, here's some generalities. I really want to have control of my deal if I can, just in the normal ownership. And I look at it from that way. But I'm saying, whatever it takes to get your deal, like, if you had to give away a lot to get into your first deal, who cares? Right? Do whatever it takes. Maybe it's just the finder's fee. Maybe you can come up with a little bit of scratch. You're like, hey, listen, I don't want to do it for 10. Give me 15%. I found this good deal, and I'll put in the earnest money. I want 15%. I want 20%. Right? That happens, and that's fair. But or you can say, I've got the deal, and then the really thing is, it's all about locking it up under contract. So if you can find someone to put in the earnest money and have at least one agreement set up to where you can get someone to fund your earnest, okay, now you actually have a deal under contract, and that's way powerful. So then you can say, hey, listen, I'm going to make some plays because I've got some time to create my buying group, and you got to do it, but you got to do it kind of pretty quick, right? And you're trying to put all that stuff together, okay? So 40% of the deal. Now, I've also given away 50% of my GP for the capital raise. But also, I'm raising capital. Just understand that I'm usually raising capital. So I'll raise usually half. So I'm always putting myself in a 75% ownership, right? So that's good for me, but it gives me the playing field of, and we'll set up these partnerships usually in the beginning before we get into a deal. And I'll usually go with people that I know that I can trust, that I know if they say they can raise $1 million, that they can actually do it. That's the biggest challenge you guys will have, is having people say they can raise money, and then they don't do it. Ask me how I know, right? Okay, now, you're supposed to. Now, a good SEC attorney will say, you set all this stuff up and it never changes, and that's probably the right answer. And the real answer is, it always sometimes changes at the end of a raise, and then we have an agreement that you didn't raise crap, and we're going to amend you out of my operating agreement when it's all said and done. And you're going to gracefully bow out. And if you're a prick, then I'll never, like, I'm going to badmouth you and make sure that everybody knows who you are. I mean, honestly, right? Like, that's, because, like, it's integrity, right? And listen, everybody can fall short, and that's okay. But, like, usually when I get together with these groups and say, guys, here's what we're going to do. Here's the plan. If we're off a couple $100,000, not a big deal. But if we tap you to raise $1 million and you raise $200,000, there's problems in Kansas, right? Like, we're going to have to, like, have a haircut. I'm not picking on you, though, but it's fun to do it, right? He's like, why are you picking on me, right? Okay. Oh, gosh, damn, I got to go faster, way faster. All right, so my point is, don't get hung up on the percentage of the first deal. Do a deal, man. Do whatever it takes to get into a deal. It's way more powerful. It's important to be in a deal. And that's really what it is. And then know your partner, right? I've said this a couple times now. Don't do partnerships, right? Do deals. You can do deals, and you can do a bad one or have a bad experience, but you're not married to that person forever. So it's really important for that. What am I doing here? Do a deal. Oh, this is me saying, let me see what I'm saying here. Oh, yeah. So I was just going to show you, this is like my Palms property, right, that I told you. So I bought it for $9.5 million, so that's 7 plus 2, right, 9.5. I bought it for $9.5 million. That's why it's important to do deals, because you never know what the market's going to do. Just go out and find a way to buy. So this was the deal. We raised $3.6 million, bought it for $9.5 million. 456 capital improvements, made 386 acquisition fee, 10 bank reserves, closing costs, some operation cash. Our goal was to sell it for $13 million when I first put this thing together. That was like when I showed my people my pro forma and what we're going to do. our goal is to sell it in year five for 13.2 and, you know, make, what, 1.8 million bucks. That sucks. Here's what we did. Is I put it under contract for 20.3, right? Same, that's the deal, like 9.5. Actually, this was when they were going to do a normal purchase. They actually did an assumption, so I don't have a defeasance fee on an assumption. So I gave them a $1.3 million credit. So we actually have it for $19 million. But anyways, that's $7 million more than my projected. So does that make me look good in my investors' eyes? Right? Is it better to under-promise and over-deliver? It really is, right? Did I do that? Absolutely, right? Is every deal this good? Not so, not really. But, like, this is why getting in the game and putting yourself in positions, that cash flow, that sometimes you get a market like what we're in now that, like, it's like a unicorn. And so I'm hitting that red button that says sell, right? And I'm going to make a little bit of cash. This one, I don't know, I think I got four. So, I mean, I own like 67% of my GP. So, not bad. All right. So, anyways, that, I just want to give the reality of like this thing, this is like real life. This is a deal about 3 years ago in Yuma, Arizona. What's in Yuma? Like the sand desert and some agricultural, some lettuce, right? They grow a lot of lettuce there. But we did it. We did a good job and we made a lot of money, right? And, you know, and here's my $62 million that we have under contract this year. Carolina Creek, 23.3. Sierra Point, that was the one that I bought with my partners that found that deal. That was in Tucson, Arizona, right? Warner Robins, another project in Warner Robins, Georgia. And then my Radford, Virginia student housing property for $18 million. All right, so those are all the projects that I'm doing this year. It's been a phenomenal year. And so here when people say they can't buy shit, I sure hells am, right? Like, how am I doing it, right? Because I just told you all the stuff that I do. Like, that's what I do. I don't, it's not any other difference than what, that's exactly what I do. Okay? All right, we're not taking a break. All right, finding management, okay? Questions you should be asking management companies. Right, we're going to go over that. We're going to ask, say, you should expect in the communications and the reporting and the accounting. What's their typical fees, right? And why I believe you should never do this, okay? You should never, I'm right at the point where I could create my own management company. Like, I'm getting to the point where I'm spending almost $1 million in management fees. I could probably take $1 million and create an award-winning organization. But with that comes a lot of people and problems, and I would only do it if I hired a CEO truly and gave them a very good business comp plan to run it as a separate business, separate from mine, right? And I still don't think I'm going to do it, right? But maybe. I'll never say no, but right now it looks like a bad idea, right? So I'm going to tell you that I think you should third-party most of your management companies out. And the reason I know that, I already told you guys my Tucson story where the deal that I lost money, right? So finding the right management companies are very important. When you find a great one, they'll do a great job, but you can also find bad ones that truly suck and it can really take you down a rabbit hole. So demanding a lot out of your management companies is very important, but it really comes with asking better questions, right? So what are you buying from a management company? You're buying systems and processes that are repeatable over a period of territory and scale, right? That's what I think you're buying, right? Most properties have what I call a regional management system, where it looks like this. You have, you know, a regional, and then you have a property, like, so call this the management company up top, and this is your property at the bottom, right? So you have a regional, you've got some support staff, and then you have right here, which is like the property manager, that's maintenance, that's a leasing person, maybe that's another leasing person. And what happens is, these are the only two people that talk. And what happens is, all these, the communication gets really watered down. I see that happen so often. And so I believe in this approach right here, We still have a lead manager, but usually you want way more vertical lines, right? Where there's different departments in your management company structure, but they're talking directly with the people that need it, right? And I think that's a way, that's what I'm looking for when I'm talking with management companies and interviewing them. I want to see something that looks a lot more like this, flatlined, and they're you know, really involved with everybody, right? The people that need it, because sometimes these people in the bottom, the ones that need the most attention, and they're not getting it because this person here is busy just doing data entry and doing all this stuff as a property manager. She can't teach and coach and train, right? So asking better questions. Now, you probably want to take a picture of this. I put a lot of it on here. So, and I'm going to go through it quick because I'm getting to the end and I want to make sure I get all the stuff. I got a couple more stories to tell. So how do you take tenants' money? So, you know, question, how do you take tenants' money? Do they ACH, right? Do they do ACH? Meaning you want to take ACH from your tenants. You do not want them cutting checks if you have to. Like, don't, like, we make sure that we don't need to have, like, if you want to cut a check, you got to send it to home office. Well, and what happens if it doesn't make it in home office in time? Well, you're going to get charged a fee. So why don't we just set you up on the ACH, right? That's actually a screen, too, because to be on ACH, they have to have a checking account, right? And some of these C properties, you're like, dude, they all got you. They will if they have it on my property. Like, that's my own. Or they're going to be getting out. Or they're going to be going to the kiosk at CVS to pay, right? Or they're going to get online. What's your lease-up sales process, right? Is it written down? What's your training process? Is it written down? Can you show me your training manual? I want to understand that you have a process of training and retaining staff because people, this is what we're in, the people business. And this is where it's most critical. And you got to have a company that really understands people because that's what management companies really are. They're a people business machine that allow, you know, that runs these properties for you. Do you have a trained employees to take over? So with my company, Asset Living, they have what's called TOPS, these TOPS employees. TOPS can get deployed at your property. Let's say, like, we used to have a property where the manager quit. And we were in the middle of looking for a assistant GM, general manager. And so now we have nobody there for coverage. So they sent in these TOPS people. So they're a deployable team that's dedicated to my manager company that travel and sit in the chair for, you know, weeks or months, whatever it takes, right? You want to know that they have that because your properties can't suffer because of their problem with people, right? Do you require manager and maintenance to live on property? I usually want somebody to live on site on all my properties. We give them, we don't give them free room, but we'll give them a discounted price. And all that's negotiations a little bit. Sometimes it's 30%. We've some done some 50%. Right? But I usually want the maintenance guy, head maintenance, to live on property. Not so much worried about the sales part of it, but I definitely want, if there's a pipe broke, I sure want maintenance to go out there and fix it quick. Okay? And then ask them, you know, what accounting system do you use? Yardi, Rent Manager, AppFolio, those types of things, because you want to understand what they're using and do you get access? What kind of access do you get? And the only access you'll accept is full owner access, right? I want to see everything. I don't have to have the ability to change anything, but I want the access to see everything. I want to be able to pull all my own reports, rent rolls, T12s, CapEx. I want to be able to pull it all on my own. I don't need to have to ask you for anything. And if they don't give you that, run. Okay? All right, so here's some of my tips and tricks. This is one of the things we do really well. Lighting matters, right? Property, living at it. Are you walking into this or do you walk up there, right? This is way bright, looks safe, and that looks like dingy, yellow, incandescent, scary, right? Now, imagine when, like, we wanted to take a picture of this to show the difference, right? And when you do that to the whole property, do you think your tenants notice? Damn right they notice. Wow. And I'm telling you that one of the biggest things you can do, number one secret weapon to dramatically make a difference is lighting. We light properties up like Christmas trees. We put wall packs in every place we can find wall packs, right? We take the breezeways, change all these lights to LEDs. A, it saves us on power. It's cleaner. It's clean, white, bright light. It works really well. And it just does the better job. Okay? It's really important. Other little things that we like to do. USB plugs, right? Kitchens and bedrooms. This little dude here. Right? Those are like 12 bucks. They're kind of, they used to be really expensive. Now they're a lot cheaper. Like 12 bucks for that. So for 100 bucks, we can, you know, put it in three bedrooms and in the kitchen. And I don't know why, but like that's a selling feature. When they walk, you know, with a kit, you know, your leasing agent saying, and check this out. And everybody's like, oh, they have a place for power. So we all got power for gadgets and stuff. And none of the older properties have this. Right? So like when you, this hotel is not great at it, but like some, even the newer health, but at least they had the alarm clock. Did you guys notice that they didn't have a iron board? Do you guys have iron boards in your rooms? I'm like, I'm supposed to go give a presentation. And I'm like, where's the iron in this place? How to call housekeeping for that. Right? But anyways, but they had at least a place where you could plug in for your power. Why? Because everybody, that's important. And so it is important for everybody. So that's why we do that. I think it's good. Other little things, knobs. Knobs on countertops, hardware, hinges, right? Big, big add-on. And just because it looks good, and it actually saves your product, too. It really does. Saves your product a lot, right? And then security. Everybody needs a little security. And, like, what we do, I mean, we put a lot of cameras everywhere. And then we put a big-ass TV in the leasing area, and we have all the live feeds plugged into it. I want everybody to know that Big Brother is watching, especially on student on campus, right, on these student properties, because we got a lot of women, a lot of girls there. We want to protect our girls. We want mom and dad when they come in with their, however mom and dad's coming, right, with the daughter, and they see all that, like, oh, I think. Because, see, the biggest question they ask is, all they want their kid is to get a good education. They're like, please don't get effed up, and like, I just want a safe place. I just want my kid to go to college. Like, you know, my daughter's getting ready to go into college, and I'm like, I'm saying the same things right now. I'm like, oh, go baby Jesus, right? Honey, she'll make all her decisions on her own, right? I just want a place that's going to be like mom to her, you know, that can keep her safe. And so that's what we do. That's the student house. That is the game, is to have a group of managers that can play mom or sub mom or whatever it is, and to create an environment that's safe and friendly and for them to thrive, right? So, but it happens no matter if it's student housing or any of that. So I'm just going to tell you, like, I don't know about you guys, the guys, I'm talking to the guys, like, I don't know how you picked the house that you live in, but for me, my wife made that decision, okay? Women usually pick. When she says that's the one, that's the one, right? If she didn't say that's the one, like, are we going to keep moving until mom says, I got it. This is the one, right? I mean, I don't know how it works for y'all, but like, I'm on the happy wife, happy life train. Okay, that's how I picked my house. When Shelly said, "Yeah, I want to live here," that's the house that we bought. We've been living there for 15 years. All right, so little things matter. Take care of the grounds. So many times over, when you buy these older properties, they're like the bushiest things you've ever seen in your life, and you really need to spend a lot of money. And a little bit of time and effort to, you know, get all that stuff trimmed down. It's usually just an absolute mess. So we do a lot of tree trimming, a lot of really heavy cutbacks, canopies. And, you know, like, if you have big hedges, like, that are way above, like, if the guy has to go like this to cut it, you know, that needs to be, it needs to be whacked down here. Right? Because go look at a new property. Does any new property have these big-ass hedges? No. So when you're ever in doubt, like, what do I do? Go to a new build and, like, and sit there and look and just, like, and take some pictures. You're like, oh. And then go back to your property and make that look like that, right? Make your landscaping look like that. Sometimes we've done it where we've taken all this big crap like that, just ripped it completely out and said, let's start fresh. And, like, you can really change that in a bucket of paint. You can change your property's looks and profile, like, super dramatically. Okay. My last thing is starter rubs. utility bill back system. A lot of your older properties, now this is starting to catch on, so there's a lot of this going on now, but not every property has it. And that's just like, on a normal apartment complex, you can get in there and let's say, you know, you're usually paying master water bill, and trash at the very minimum and sewer, right? So you can, charge and start charging that back to your tenants. It's called the residential utility bill back. And it could be like, hey, listen, it's, rent $625 and a, you know, $15 REBS fee. And just like that, I raised my rents $15. Right? It's the easiest $20 bump that you'll ever find in the business. And it's just sitting there. Because your advertising rates are $625 with everybody else. And then, oh, but in REBS. And they're like, oh, well, okay. Because everybody thinks they got to, you know, yeah, that makes sense. I got to pay utilities. Right? Even though they're master billed, but that's how you get it back. Right, so that's another really nice little money maker idea that we use a lot that makes us money. All right, perfect. Right, all right. Okay, we're coming to the end. Right, this is the last 30 minutes. Okay, so this is my favorite story that I'll probably ever tell. Right, so. I have two stories left that I think are really good, and this is one of them. So, and this is, I tell the story because I want you to understand that, the reason and my intent, and so, my dad was a roofer, so I'm gonna teach you the three things that my dad taught me, and I think it's just really important to share. And, you know, my dad was a roofer growing up as a young kid. I mean, he was, in my eyes, my dad was a Greek god. Right? My dad would, like, if we were kids, would be like, my dad kick your dad's butt. Right? That's just what it was. But in my eyes, my dad was an absolute Greek god. And I remember as a young boy, 5 years old, all I could want to do, ever I ever wanted to do, was be on the roof with my dad. Right? And my dad, you know, and I'd beg him, Dad, can I go? Can I go? Because I was a young kid, but I was really mature at 5 years old. I don't know why. But Dad would, you know, so Dad let me come. And I remember the first time I was on the roof with my dad. And Dad got on his knees and he kind of looked me in the eyes and goes like, son, today's going to be a lot of hard work, right? But here's what we're going to do. Today we're going to make work a game. And the game that we're going to play today is who can get to the top of the ridge first, right? And I was like, oh, yeah, because there was another roofer on the other side. It was just an A-frame house. And I was like, game on. Now, my job as a five-year-old was to take the bundles of shingles and unstick them and lay them out for my dad so my dad could take the gun and go pop, 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 and lay it out, pop, pop, pop. And that's what my dad did. I mean, I'm telling you, we went to town. And, dude, we didn't just win. Like, we probably won by a country mile, right? And, dude, I remember sitting there on top of that roof, and I was like, oh, my God, it feels so good. And that was my dad. I was so proud. But what happens next is really one of the defining moments in my life as a young kid where my dad looked at, because we were sitting on top of the ridge, you know, like we're done. And Dad said, hey, son, let's jump over here. Let's go to the other side. I don't know why I did. I get a little bit. But let's go help this other roofer bring his shingles. All the way to the top, right? And like, let's lend him a hand. And I don't know why it was such a profound thing for me at that young age, but like, I saw the humility in him for me, right? As a young boy, like it wasn't just about winning, right? So many times in our lives we get focused on trying to win and do these things. And here we're playing a game. It's a lot of hard work, but Dad was showing me another side of like, help your fellow man. Don't be a dick. Right? And I remember we jumped on and we helped that roofer bring his shingles all the way to the other side. So, but the lesson was make work a game. Make work a game. And I've done that all my life. The second thing that my dad taught me was that, you know, my dad was a catcher. He actually graduated or got out of high school and got drafted by the Cleveland Indians as a catcher, right? He got taken out at home plate. He had some back surgery, so his career was over, but he never lost love for the game. So he was my baseball coach. And I remember him saying, you know, son, when you go up to bat, swing for the fences. Don't ever be ashamed, son. Go out there and give it your all. Swing for the fences. Give it your all. But son, when you do that and you give it all like that, more often than not, you're going to strike out. Right? And what you do in that moment, it matters. Right? He goes, collect yourself. Don't make a show of it. Grab your bat, son. Start hustling back to the dugout. But as you're hustling back to the dugout, you look at that pitcher right in the eye and you say, you may have got me this time, but I'm coming up again and I'm going to get you. I'm coming back. Right? Swing for the fences. Dad always told me, don't ever be ashamed of it. You'll never feel bad about giving it your all. Last thing my dad taught me as a young kid was that, you know, hustle in everything you do. Hustle. Right? Like, I don't know about you guys, but in life, life is hard. It does not wait. It does not care. Like, Dad would say, son, if the coach says go run around that light post, you better be first. Right? Because the only way you're not first is if someone physically beats you. Because that's normally a mental game, playing that little thing to do the little extra work that it requires. Most people are never willing to do it. He goes, Corey, hustle in everything you do. You'll never be ashamed. You can always look someone in the eye when you give it your all and you hustle. And that's the way it is in life. The worm goes to the person that gets there early. Period. Very important to me. So three things my dad taught me. And for me, I've used it all my life, is to make work a game, you know, swing for the fences, and then hustle in everything you do. And it served me really well. And so just like in life, so I kind of go on my little sales pitch here, but here's the thing. You know, we talked about Bruce early, right, early on, right, my whole dreams. For the guy that got here late, my kahuna story, like I found Bruce. His name was Bruce Wayne. Bruce never taught me the business, right? He never did, but I want to teach you. And so I have this thing called the Kahuna Boardroom, right? That's where I teach. I spent pretty much all damn day, got 15 minutes left on my watch to finish it up and bring it home, and about what I do and what I teach, right? So I love this game, and I feel like the boardroom event is kind of what you got in this day, but it's a 3-day event, plus we have a lot more stuff, and I'm going to go over it. But it's the place where I've taught a lot of people how to be successful in multifamily, and it's worked really well, okay? Because I believe that cash flow is legacy. Having that life, creating that lifestyle, it's everything, right? But I think you need a roadmap. It's not easy to get there, but you can get there, right? So at the boardroom, you get these things here. You get our Raising Private Capital program. You get how to find apartment deals. We've talked a lot about it, but we go to some other ways to do it. How to analyze deals, so that cash flow calculator that you got. We go in it way more detail. We give you the support. Unlock your deal flow. Speaking the secret. Like, we give you the words. Like, there's a secret language to broker talk. You know, it's a different jargon. And if you don't know it, they're going to know you're new. They're going to know it, right? And so, you know, we talk about dialing in. I'm going to dial in. I don't know why we use the word dial in, but I'm trying to dial in my CapEx. But that's a word that we use, dial in. And so it's just, if you can use the same words that brokers are used to using, it's going to help you look more like legit. I always say street smart education because that's what I teach. I teach it on the reels, right? I never sugarcoat it. I just tell you how it is, right? There's not good news or bad news, it's just the news, right? And, you know, setting up yourself for success. Basically, I just give you everything I've ever created for any of the stuff. I just give it to you, right? So there is nothing you can buy at that event, by the way. There's no sales. There's nothing for sale. You can't buy shit if you show up. So don't worry about me trying to say, oh, this is the event that you go to upsell you. Okay, I'm not going to do that, okay? But I do give you everything that I have. So we talked, I don't have that credibility kit, but, you know, we even like, I brought it just so I want to show you guys. But like, you know, I create this newsletter. This is what I give to all of my investors, the newsletters, right? And so we're cool enough that we just give you the Adobe Illustrator files of all this. So you can go give it to Fiverr, somebody on Fiverr, and have them create it with your logo. And if you, you know, probably ask me really nice, I'll get my team to do it one for you or something. I don't know. But, like, just, you know, I give you everything. I just think it's important just to be open book. And I've had a lot of success in my life, but I didn't get there on my own. And I realized that the more I give, the more I get. And so I've just learned to just give it all. And, you know, there is no, you know, secret sauce. It's just a little bit of hard work and the right effort and the right information can get you successful. We talk about the cash flow calculator. Deal partnering, I do it. Right? I can't do it for everybody, but I do a lot of student deals, right? Because that's my little finder. That's why I teach, right? I know they're going to find it. They're going to need someone like me to help. And so I'm cool with that. I can't do them all, but I do as many, and I help them put Voltron together if I can, right? So I'll show them the way. I think that's important. More importantly, like, I only let 60 people into this event. And I don't know how many people are here, but, like, it's just 60. When I hit 60, I don't let anywhere else come because it's not worth it to me. I'll say it again, but I just want you guys to hear me. Like, I do real estate. I own apartments. That's where I make millions of dollars, and I'm happy with my millions, right? I'm good. I do this because I love it, right? But and I try to give as much access. I've given you a lot of people that come up here. I've given you my phone number, you know, because I don't hide. I'm not Ron LeGrand, right? I'm not that famous, but I'm just famous enough, I guess. But and maybe that's why I probably don't do a lot of events because I don't want to be that guy. I don't want to be a traveling sales guy. I'm a family guy that stays home most of the time. But I come and do this name because I think I can help people get to the next level. And the last story I want to tell you, I want this one to hit home. And this is a hard story for me to tell. But I'm going to tell it. So, like, I can only tell you guys the pain of being a workaholic. Okay, and not putting your family first. I've shown you guys that I'm a family guy, but I'm telling you that I've screwed it up royally. Okay? I've not been that perfect dad, or the dad that I thought I was, or that I meant to be. And early on, when I was in a single family fix and flip, I let my business consume me. I pray that you're not there. But for me, this is my life. Was so chaotic and crazy. I was tied to my phone. And it was just, I was 24/7 doing deals, managing rehabs, doing fix and flips, finding money, running my rehabs on my single family project side. And I remember there was a time where my son looks at me and he goes, "Dad, got a game setter. You gonna be there?" "Yeah, son, you can count on me." But inside I was like, dude, there's three properties that I didn't look at. And I was like, I'm gonna wake up early in the morning. I'm gonna go see these properties. I'm gonna go do it. Right? And then I'll make it back in time for the game at like 2:00. Wake up, go to the first property. Man, there's all kinds of things wrong. I'm like, shit, I gotta run to Lowe's, doing stuff. And then, okay, I'm running behind. I'm like, oh, okay. Second property, same stuff. Now painter problems. Another trip to Lowe's, and I'm like, and the long story short is, man, I got there at the end of my son's game. The hardest part is watching your son come off that field and crying. Saying, "Dad, you promised." And I have his head, and he's crying in my chest. I mean, big tears. And I feel about this big. And I don't know why I tell the story, because it's hard for me to tell. I promise myself I'd tell it every time I speak. Because I see so many people get stuck in doing in the pursuit of money and things that are not important, that it's not, you know, kids, I'm telling you, sorry for going through that, but it's hard to tell that story because I see my son coming off that field and crying and just that, just a tough cry, dude. And to the look in his eyes that I got, it was just so devastating for me that it cut me something bad. That here I am telling this story and I'm just reliving it as I tell it. And it's painful. It's raw. It's painful still today. And I don't want you guys to feel that. I just don't, right? I remember, and kids are resilient, so of course Connor, my son, still wants to jump in the car with me and have me take him home as he's the whole time and right there. And I was like, God, you're killing me right now, because like it's just like more injury to insult. And I feel so bad. And I remember going home. My wife, you know, looks at me and she's like, you got to fix this, man. Like, this is no bueno. And, but she did it with grace. She didn't yell at me. She just told me that's, you know, you need to make a change. And so I remember I got in my truck and I started driving by myself. And dude, I'm telling you, I am cussing at myself. You son of a bitch. Why did you put money in front? Like, what the hell were you thinking? Why did you think that? How do you think this was going to go? You know, and I'm telling you, for a good 30 minutes, just beating myself up. And I finally get it all out, and I'm empty. And I ask God to forgive me, right? Forgive me for just not doing the right thing, not putting, you know, I talk about family first, but I wasn't putting it first. I was putting me first, right? And my kid checked me. My son checked me. And so in that empty state, something magical happened. As I asked God for forgiveness, and I'm driving, and I just knew that I needed something different, and that's when it happened. I drove by an apartment complex. And I used to say, man, I wish I could own an apartment complex. And in that broken state, with nothing left, I think God touched me. And he said, look over here. And I see this apartment complex, and I did something that I've never done. I've done it, but I just changed the way I said it. I said, how can I own an apartment complex? And the moment I said those words, everything changed. My mind flashed back to that vision I had 15 years ago or 10 years ago when I was at Bruce's house. Bruce had the cash flow life. He had time and money. And his two words was real estate, but apartments. And I knew that that was the answer. I did a U-turn. I went to Barnes & Noble's. I bought every book I could on commercial real estate. And now I stand before you as a very successful real estate investor, doing great deals, making lots of money. But I have control of my time now. So much so that, listen, I am supposed to go and speak tomorrow or be on a panel tomorrow. And I've told you this. My son made playoffs, and tomorrow's game day. And I'm flying home in the morning. And I make no apologies for it. None. Right? That's the power I think that real estate can give you, is it gives you a big O F U button. Right? I don't think I want to do that. I'm going to put the right things first. And I challenge all of you guys to put the right things first, to get crystal clear in your vision of what you want and how you're going to get there. Because in my mind, real estate, multifamily apartments is it. It can give you that success model where you don't have to be like I was and let your kids down, right? Because it was a horrible feeling that I swear I want nobody to go through, right? I'll say this. So if you went to my event, so, and I'm going to give you the price here. It's real cheap. I've already told you once, but I'll do it again. But if all you did was learn how to raise $100,000 in private money, would that help you out? I think it would, right? If all you did was do a deal, one deal in the next year, would that get you there? Most people would say, yep, that would be, right? Or if you only found a deal, right? You couldn't do it, but you found it, and you found somebody to partner with and give you some GP. that would probably be worth it. If you did that for 5 years in a row, you'd still have some stuff, right? And I say this, the board room, I only let 60 people in. Guys, I'm not a guru. I'm not. I'm a deal maker. That's what I do. I like doing real estate deals. I enjoy the process. I like finding ways to put together people and watch them flourish. I think that's my thing. But at my event, you do get my contact information. I don't hide. People want to get on my calendar, they book 30-minute booking links. I got 30-minute booking links you can get on my calendar. That's how it works, right? I'm pretty accessible to my tribe, right? And that's how I've built my business, is I want to be accessible. But I also don't want to, like, overwork, and I don't travel the world, and I don't travel a lot. I do all my events in Phoenix. Why? Because I live in Phoenix, right? So if you want to, like, I come to this one, but it was hard. I mean, they had to really talk to me because I do. I'm a Phoenix guy. So here's what it is. So this is not for everybody, but you do get all this stuff. Like my 3-day intensive, it's $7,500. But really, I charge $5,000. I normally charge $5,000 for my Kahuna boardroom, but my multifamily course, a cash flow calculator, our deal partnering, I'll say that's $50,000. But I mean, I just want to do deals. I'll show you how to do deals. Credibility kit, me creating that whole thing for you is, I think, invaluable. I'll call it $64,000, but that's my sales pitch, right? So whatever. I'm just being real honest, right? We put these numbers up here to make it look like it's all some crazy shit, right? Right? I like it. I mean, you got to do it. I'm the worst salesman ever, damn it, right? Okay, but here's the truth. This is. There's only one more slide after this one. Okay, so but here it is, right? So it's 14 or no, it's 19. Oh, is it? So there we go. I screwed it up. It's 14.97. I can't even get that right. It's 14.97. Okay, there's a special deal today only. I can't believe I screwed that up. I did that last night. That's what happened, Bethany. Bethany, I was like, Bethany, I got to put the price on the thing. I can't remember what I put it. It's $14.97. I will tell you right now. How do you sign up right now? Is this for everybody? Let us know. Raise your hands if you think this is right for you guys. Right? Yeah. Okay. Go back in the back. My guys, my team right there. They're all ready for you. It's $14.97. That event's going to be April 21st through the 23rd in Scottsdale, Arizona. Guys, I'm going to come back here and I'm going to answer some questions. But if you're ready to like take your step to the next level, I promise you my event is probably the best that you'll ever attend. I know that because I give it all, right? I give you everything I got. There's nothing to buy. There's nothing for sale, right? There's nothing, right? We give it all to you. We make it very special. That just even the marketing, the whole credibility kit. If I will tell you, like, to get that thing, to have all my properties and your name up top, and it's in your logo and your brand, that alone is the cost just to get into my event, right? Because that's giving you credibility. I'm sharing. I'm taking the risk that you're not going to go out and slander, right? That's why I only do it for 60 people. Because it's that important to me, right? I can help you. I can be available to you. So if that's you, let's follow. Everybody come to me. We're gonna come to the back right now. Everybody get up. Like, we can stand. We can go. Come on back here. This is me doing the cattle call. Come on. Come on. And we're coming back here. And guys, I want to thank you from the very bottom of my heart for taking your time and spending all day with me, right? If you want to change your life, come on back. Sign up for my course. And it'll be the only time that I offer it for this price. It's the only time that I'll ever offer it because it's the last one that I'll ever do, right? So if you guys are really interested in making that little commitment to yourself, it's not a lot of money. I understand it's a little money. I think there's a 2-payment option, too, for everybody. But I encourage you guys to come back. I'm going to turn off my mic, and let's get back in the back, and let's make some deals.